Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Now we'd like to take a few minutes to remember U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Damon Keith. He died last month at the age of 96. Memorial services for him are being held today. Judge Keith served on the federal bench for more than 50 years, and his rulings in cases involving school desegregation, employment discrimination, and government surveillance made him one of the most influential jurists of recent decades. But Judge Keith was also known for hiring and mentoring a remarkably diverse group of clerks, many of whom have gone on to become prominent in their own right. One of them is former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, and she's with us now from Berkeley, California. Governor, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you bet.
And we are sorry for the loss of this important figure in your life and the lives of many other people. You've referred to Judge Keith as a mentor, and even more than a mentor. Tell us a little bit, if you would, about how you came to clerk for him and why he meant so much to you.
Well, first of all, more than a mentor, I called him my father in Michigan. My own father was three time zones away in California, and Judge Keith really became like a surrogate father to me when I was in Michigan. And I came to clerk for him because when I went to law school, I was the editor-in-chief of the Civil Rights Law Review at Harvard, Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review, and I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer, and I wanted to clerk for a judge who had that line of cases that demonstrated a commitment to that, and Judge Keith obviously had that. So I applied to him and felt so honored when he selected me because he was such an icon. So I became to be, you know, part of the Keith family of law clerks. And believe me, it's quite an extended family.
Does any moment in your clerkship stick out to you that you can share with us without violating sort of confidentiality of the chambers or anything of that sort?
You know, if I had to answer that question and say that the most soaring memory that I have about him is how he treated us. I mean, he walked the talk in terms of making sure that people felt seen. So Judge Keith is like an icon, and he goes to all these big events, and he's always the keynote speaker and all of that. But he would invite the clerks and the secretaries to every one of those speeches. And before he even began speaking, he would make sure that these lowly law clerks and the lowly administrative staff in front of these big kahunas always stood up and got applause. You know, we felt like, wow, we are really something special. And he would tell us that. And there, if you can imagine in your life, thinking about a boss that you are still in touch with, or that you've remained in touch with through your whole life because they care so deeply about you personally, that's Judge Keith. This is why all of his clerks are going to be standing vigil at the casket, because we all feel this same sense of connection to somebody who cared so deeply about us.
Do you have any sense of what caused him to care so much about treating people in that way, or about making sure that his clerks were, and his secretaries and his administrative staff were all recognized? Do you have any idea why he felt that way?
Yeah, I mean, his life, he never forgot where he came from. You know, he came from obviously a legacy of slavery, which was not distant from him, but he also, I mean, he was reminding us always that when he got a job as a janitor sweeping floors, he was asked by somebody, "What do you want to be?" And he says, "I want to be a lawyer." And the person said, "Keep mopping." because that's not going to happen for you, because obviously it was way back in the day, he's an African-American man, and people didn't see that he had possibility. But he knew deep inside that he did. He used to tell us that we walk, this is his quote, he used to tell us all the time, we walk on floors that we never scrubbed, we walk through doors that we never opened. I love that he never forgot where he came from.
And speaking of kind of beginnings, you're a white woman from Canada.
Right.
He was also known for hiring a large number of African-American clerks at a time. And apparently this is still not as common as many people believe and understand it should
number.
Be. But
I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. I think I was only the second white clerk that he had ever hired. He really made sure that African Americans had an opportunity. So he went specifically to Howard to recruit people. And I think one of the reasons I was privileged enough to be able to work for him was because I was the editor in chief of the Civil Rights Law Review. And so he knew that I was committed to the cause, but he really was known for uplifting the clerks that came behind, you know, the African-American clerks in particular, obviously, who wanted to work for a court of appeals judge, because this is a high level clerkship. And he wanted to make sure the door was open for them.
How would you want people to think about Judge Keith and his legacy?
I can only answer this in the immediate context because I'm so struck by the parallels with his decisions that were all about transparency in government and sort of what is happening today politically in Washington, D.C., and the failure to respond to subpoenas and all that. I mean, he wrote some amazing decisions that I think led to the Washington Post's motto being democracy dies in darkness. He wrote democracy dies behind closed doors because he had written decisions about transparency in government, which will live long beyond his time on the bench and his life on earth. And those lessons are lessons I hope we take to heart today in the current context.
That's Jennifer Granholm. She is the former governor of Michigan, a former clerk to Judge Damon Keith, and she's currently teaching at the University of California, Berkeley. Governor, thank you so much for talking with us.
You bet. Thanks.
Ultra-processed foods dominate the American diet. Chips, soda, and packaged snack bars, but also breakfast cereals, energy bars, and ready-to-eat meals. The rise of these highly processed foods has coincided with growing rates of obesity. That's led many to suspect these foods have played a big role in our growing waistlines. But is it something about the highly processed nature of these foods that drives people to overeat? A new study suggests the answer is yes. NPR's Maria Godoy reports.
The study comes from researchers at the National Institutes of Health. They recruited 20 healthy adult men and women to live at NIH for a whole month.
You know, we actually have to house people and measure every morsel of food that they eat because we can't rely on self-reports.
That's NIH researcher Kevin Hall. He led the study. One group of people was randomly assigned to eat an ultra-processed diet. So think foods like packaged white bread, eggs made with liquid mix, and peaches canned in heavy syrup. The other group ate unprocessed foods. After 2 weeks on one diet, the group switched to the opposite diet. Both groups were allowed to eat as much or as little as they wanted. And meals in both diets contained the same number of calories, carbs, protein, and other nutrients.
And this is, I think, critically important. A diet that's matched for a lot of the usual suspects that people think of when they think of ultra-processed food.
Specifically, fat, salt, and sugar. And sugar is known to drive hunger.
our study didn't allow the diets to be different in that regard, and yet we still saw a big effect of the ultra-processed diet.
How big an effect? People on the highly processed diet ate about 500 calories more per day, and they gained an average of 2 pounds over 2 weeks. People on the unprocessed diet? They ended up losing an average of 2 pounds over the same period.
You know, these are landmark findings that the processing of the foods makes a huge difference in how much a person eats.
That's Dariush Mazafarian. He's the dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. He says while the study was small, it's significant because it was so highly controlled. Unlike prior observational studies that linked ultra-processed foods to weight gain, this study can show cause and effect.
These findings are really consistent with a lot of evidence that, you know, we can't judge a food by its calories.
In other words, for healthy weight management, eat real foods like fruits and vegetables, whole grains, fish, and nuts. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
5, 4, 3.
She's pure alligator. Pure white.
2. Albinos that do make it to reproductive age can't find a mate because they look funny.
1. Albino
bears.
But right now, a project of passion.
People often ask me how we got to this point. Why do we fight and plunder the world until nothing is left? The harder question to answer is to why we give everything to a cause that seems so hopeless. I don't know the answers to these questions, but all I know is our story.
That's the voice of James Mwende in a powerful new documentary called Kifaru. Kifaru means rhinoceros in Swahili, and the story is about a northern white rhino, a male rhino named Sudan, the very last male of his kind. Following last week's grim UN report that showed as many as a million species are on the verge of the same fate, Sudan's story has even more resonance. Kifaru tells the story of the people who loved and cared for Sudan in his final days, including two rangers, James Mwende, who you just heard, and Joseph Wachira. They both join me from San Francisco, and with me in Toronto is the director of Kifaru, David Hambridge. Hello, everyone, and welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
James Mwende, let's start with you. Tell me about Sudan. Who was he? How did he come to be at the Conservancy?
Sudan got his name from southern Sudan, where he was born. Unfortunately, there was civil strife in that country, and he was taken for refuge in a zoo in Czech Republic. And so he stayed in the zoo for quite a number of years. And as a breeding program, he was brought back again to Africa to see whether the essence of being in the African soil would, you know, get him made together with the females that he came along with. And so then he came to Olpejeta Conservancy in 2009, December.
And did he mate with a female?
Unfortunately, no. The intention was Sudan not to directly mate with the females that are there, was to mate with the southern white rhinos as a way of trying to crossbreed, because the two girls we have are kind of like, one of them is his daughter, and the other one is granddaughter. So he wasn't able to mate because actually his age advanced with time since he came in 2009, and so he wasn't able to mate.
In the clip, we hear you say the work you do is hopeless. Do you really believe that?
That's actually is based on what people think and ask. Why do you have to do this if it seems they're the last, you know, two of their kind now? People say, like, why do you have to be there every day for these animals that tend? Why do you have to put so much effort on them when they're going, you know, you need to focus on other things? But the thing is that we can't let this species down and just watch them go down. So you have to try and do the best you can.
Joseph Wachira, what made you decide to become a ranger at Olpejeta?
At the beginning, I did not know about taking care of animals. But when I went and working in conservancy, I used to be a cooker. And I used to see my colleagues working with rhinos. And they are working very well, so I started thinking maybe want to be working with rhinos.
What is it about the rhinos that you wanted to work with them?
It's because how they were gentle, and also, you know, it's a big animal, like 3 ton. And sometimes it's a little bit hard to believe you can be able to work with a big animal.
That's true, aren't we? As we watch, we forget how big they are because they seem so natural with you. Joseph, the job of a ranger doesn't pay very well or have a lot of prestige in Kenya. Why not?
Yeah, like I used to have a lot of friends, which one we grow with them together. But because of knowing which one I do, working with rhinos, cleaning the rhinos, correcting the poop and to put the area very well. So they're starting saying because them they have a good job. So they're starting saying like, that work is not very nice. You could come and then we could be able to find you a good job, which one you can be able to have a lot of money. But that one, because I know to be working with rhinos is not just only for fun, but you know you are trying to help.
And you're also guarding them.
Yeah.
James, why do rhinos in Kenya need armed guards?
It's basically due to the fact that they are endangered. We have to admit that we have taken what is primarily theirs, that is their land, and the demand for their horn is still there. And if we don't do what we do to protect them, then it seems in the next 10 or 15 years there won't be any rhinos.
David Hambridge, the rhino horn, and we see this at the end, the rhino horn is prized. It's worth a lot of money. It's carved. It's so this is why they're so vulnerable to poachers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the belief in, you know, when we were in Hong Kong, James and I went there, and we actually went to a lot of schools, and James spoke, you know, to them very directly, and they were very intrigued and interested in everything he was doing, and he was dressed up, you know, he was wearing his ranger uniform. But they actually thought that the rhino horn just falls off the rhino, and the ranger's job is to pick it up. And that's how the horn is, you know, that's where it comes from. And so there's a lot of misinformation. And
because they kill the rhino to get the
horn.
They
do, yeah.
They don't just cut it off even, right? They want the whole thing. They kill them.
They go very deep, yeah. And so, you know, James and JoJo know this, but there's, you know, the scene is very gruesome and it's really sad because it can even go all the way down to, you know, cutting through their pathways, their air pathways. So they're kind of just, it's, you know, it's very grotesque, actually. I don't want to describe it too much in detail, but it's very sad and tragic, and it's still happening. You know?
And that's why the two gentlemen who are our guests as well are so important in this process to protect them. How did you get interested in the story of Sudan, David?
I really have to attribute it to James and Joseph. I mean, I went there and I met Sudan myself, and he was magnificent. He was pretty healthy then. This was in 2015. I spent a lot of time, well, I spent about a week there kind of running around by myself. I have to say, you know, meeting JoJo and really one of the last days, I talked to James at this place called the Information Center. I could just tell that he was probably the most connected to the rhinos, and they really had a bond, and I just wanted to talk to him, you know, and see like what is your life like, and kind of what's it like taking care of this animal that's being, you know, billed in the mainstream media as the last of his kind. And I just kept going back after that.
James, how many rhinos are left at the conservancy?
We actually boast of having the largest population of black rhinos in Eastern Central Africa. Opegeta holds approximately 123 black rhinos and like 36 southern white rhinos and the two northern white rhinos. You know, rhinos are like our signature species in Opegeta Conservancy. focusing on them has helped us to keep safe the 90,000 acres of Opejita Conservancy.
And now at one point in the documentary, we see Jacob, and he's running around in the field with Sudan, waving his arms and playing with this giant rhino. And one of you guys says he's like a rhino himself. What's that about?
Well, at the end of the day, you realize our job from a wider perspective, or a wider view of it, is emotionally draining. And these moments of excitement have to be induced for us to keep our job as exciting as possible. So you can assume, for us being young as we are, and Jacob being like our elder, leading us, and then he's up there playing and jumping with the rhinos, is really like, you know, so there are those moments that you seize and just tick off all the work and, you know, get to enjoy working with these animals. They can be scaring, they can be dangerous, but if you have a light moment to play with a rhino, it's a cool thing, you know.
I was kind of amazed because they are so big. Would you guys say 3 tons? And of course, there's the baby that you find and rescue. And Jojo, Joseph, the little one follows you around like it's a puppy. Like, he just follows you.
Yeah, because when the day we rescued him, he was almost 2 weeks old. And also, I was the first one to give him formula milk.
With a giant baby bottle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So from that time, I take responsible, like, to be his mom or his father. So, and then we communicate. So he used to follow me wherever I go. It was like a small dog following me wherever I go.
David, we see in the film that he's euthanized. The veterinarians take tissue samples to create a new rhino embryo. Where is all of that?
So that is, there's a science, international team of scientists, Dr. Mornay de la Rey from South Africa. He was actually the one that, when Sudan was euthanized, he took the DNA samples from his trachea, his ear, his testicular tissue, you know, all sorts of places in his body where the genetics would be useful for the future, and cryogenically froze them. So I followed Dr. Mornay to the lab and filmed for about 8 hours, 10 hours or so, until it was cryogenically frozen. But where they are with, you know, the IVF, which is kind of the last hope until you have to go to methods like cloning, which, you know, have ethical, you know, things around them. So I think the IVF is, they've been working on it and practicing. The Czech Republic Zoo, which is where these rhinos came from, they're spearheading the science, and they're doing a really great job at it. And they're actually going to be extracting the eggs from Fatu, who's Sudan's granddaughter and the youngest and of the last two northern white females left, and using IVF to use maybe her eggs if it's successful. Obviously, it's also very risky to do, and even the slightest mistake could be devastating. And then they would take frozen male northern white sperm and implant that embryo in a southern white female surrogate mother. And that one is actually at Opejeta, and they keep her around Najin and Fatu, the last two females, to kind of, I guess, inspire the wild nature of being a wild rhino.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
And it's time again for StoryCorps. 15 years ago today, Massachusetts became the first state to legalize same-sex marriage. Weddings started that same day. David Wilson was a plaintiff in the lawsuit that led to marriage equality in Massachusetts. Listeners might remember him from a story back in 2010. He talked about losing his first partner to a heart attack.
When I got to the hospital, they were not going to give me any information. They called his family in Vermont and said, can you give permission for us to talk to David? And his 75-year-old mom said, of course, they're partners. So they came out and they said that he was dead on arrival.
A few years later, David Wilson met Rob Compton. They became one of the first legally married same-sex couples in the U.S.
I was new to Boston. I just came from Michigan, where I was fired when I came out at work. And so I was looking to meet people, and I stumbled across you.
I think you slipped me a business card, if I remember correctly.
Well, I'm not sure who slipped who the card, but you started talking about your family and your kids. Having been married myself for over 20 years and having kids, and that's actually one of the things that really attracted me.
At that point, we began to think about, well, maybe we'll go out on a date. And the first year that we were living together, you woke up at 3 a.m. and had pretty excruciating pain. And we drove off to the hospital. And that was the very same hospital that my former partner was brought to. But I thought 3 years later, I would be treated at least as your partner, which I wasn't. That was the beginning for us of thinking about how do we get legal protections for each other.
Back then, most people were not supporting civil unions, let alone marriage. We had one death threat. And the day of the wedding, we had to actually have police all around us, and they had snipers up on the roof trying to make sure nothing happened. But that day, Arlington Street Church was filled to the brim.
We had our two grandsons, who were 4 and 2, walk down the aisle ahead of us. And I do remember our minister saying, by the power vested in me.
By the power vested in me, by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
And then we had a pause while the church erupted.
People clapping and banging their feet.
And then she said,
I hereby pronounce you legally married.
And that's when we realized that day wasn't about us. And this really was for thousands and thousands of people.
For me, as we approach the 15th anniversary, I have no concerns now about introducing you as my husband. No one's going to challenge that. No one's going to ask me for a marriage license, which right after we got married, we started carrying our marriage license everywhere we went. Here we are 15 years later, and I don't even know where it is.
David Wilson talking with his husband, Rob Compton. 15 years ago, they became one of the first same-sex couples to be legally married in the U.S. Their conversation will be archived at the Library of Congress.
Yours, I go like this. Listen, just touching on some real issues right here tonight. That's all.
That's all. That's
I want y'all to observe the excellence here. BX providing the sonics, my man, Minnesota. I'm letting the beat ride out because it's a part that I like when it come up, you know what I'm saying? I take this time to say what's up to my family. You hear that? You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
Just observe the excellence of that. That's many.
Then. Hey, back. Fall back.
With the guitars. It's hip-hop music. It's good enough to speak for itself. And you got to do right by it. Minnesota.
Black people in Minnesota?
Minnesota is the land of 10,000 lakes, but what to call one of those bodies of water is stirring up controversy. Elizabeth Shockman from Minnesota Public Radio reports.
What exactly should the official name be for Minneapolis Public Water number 27-31, a lake located in Minneapolis?
Bede-Makoska.
Calhoun.
Bede-Makoska.
Lake Calhoun.
Calhoun.
Bede-Makoska.
This is a question being hotly debated by Minnesota residents and lawmakers, especially after a Minnesota appellate court ruled last month that the decision to change the lake's name from Calhoun to Bede-Makoska was illegal. Whatever you call it, this lake on the highly visible chain within Minneapolis city limits has a long history of trading names. It was known by its Dakota name Bede-Makoska prior to the 1800s. Then it was renamed Lake Calhoun after John C. Calhoun, a South Carolina statesman, former vice president, secretary of state, and proponent of slavery. Kate Bean is a public historian and member of the Flandreau Santee Sioux tribe. She was part of the group that worked to get the lake's name restored to Bede-Makoska.
I think it's important to honor and respect Dakota language in this land. And we want to create a space where we can come together, where we can all feel welcome and feel proud of the places in which we live.
Last year, a former Minnesota DNR commissioner agreed with Bean and ordered the name changed to its original Dakota. However, a group called Save Lake Calhoun challenged that, and late last month, the Minnesota Appeals Court agreed the DNR didn't have the authority to change a lake name that's been in use for over 40 years. Attorney Eric Cardell represents the Save Lake Calhoun group.
The moral of the story is that, you know, public officials violating the law is not part of our Minnesota tradition. Don't violate the law. That's not how Minnesota works.
This controversy over what to call a beloved lake chafes at familiar American quarrels over the names of schools, monuments, and buildings. And Minnesota legislators have taken up the fight. Democrats want to write Bademakoska into Minnesota law, but Republicans say they prefer the name Calhoun and want more public discussion. Down on the three-mile trail that runs around the beloved Minneapolis body of water, longtime friends Barbara Lordy, age 66, and Sharon Bordoff, age 77, say they too disagree over what the lake should be called.
Yeah, right, we're really right. Good friends.
Right. Lordy wants to stick with the name Bademakoska. Bordoff wants to keep the name Calhoun.
Well, I have a hard time with changing the names of things because of judging people from a different time in a different setting. Now, given that, I had no idea what Lake Calhoun was, who it was named after. God, how much do I want to advocate for this racist, you know?
They say they've learned a lot about each other recently thanks to the lake controversy.
Getting into some edgy conversations and then backing off and thinking about it and, I don't know, mallowing perhaps, or I don't know.
Lordy, however, says she and her friend recognize that they, as white women, have a certain privilege in how they're able to discuss the issue.
Someone with Native history, and it is more powerful and more painful for them to see the name Calhoun.
In the meantime, the Minnesota DNR says it's taking the name fight to the state Supreme Court. They say they've changed names of state geographic features more than 24 times in the last decade. None has been as fiercely debated as this one. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Shockman in St. Paul.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
It has gone viral, shared not only by students here at Palo Verde High School, but people throughout this entire community. You see a student singing a song with very racist lyrics. Now, we do have to warn you, we were able to cut out the curse words, but the words that you can hear are very upsetting to listen to.
Burn in hell. Harsh. I'll slap that bitch as well.
That student is then heard continuing using the N-word multiple times with the quote-unquote threat, need to burn. Now, along with the Clark County School District, the principal of Palo Verde High School, that's Darren Squiker, he is also speaking out against this video. In a message sent out to parents this week, the principal is quoted saying, "My top priority is to ensure your child is safe at school. Behavior like this will not be tolerated at our school nor anywhere in the Clark County School District." This is also not the first racist incident to go public within the CCSD this week alone. Those allegations going to a middle school here. Now, a local rabbi speaking out this past Tuesday after his Escobedo middle school daughter found a note with a swastika on it, along with the words, "You don't belong here." District officials are also still dealing with concerns from local parents and kids after two students were arrested in March when photos were posted on social media of black students over at Arborview High School, along with racist captions and threats to open fire on that school there. Well, today, Palo students say enough is enough.
And I feel bad for like the races that had to listen to that, and I just feel like it's messed up and no one should ever even say that. And I don't think it was a good idea whatsoever, and he should have never even said that.
And when it comes to this latest incident in this specific student here at Palo Verde High School, the Clark County School District isn't speaking specifically on any disciplinary actions taken against him, but more as an umbrella general rule, they are saying that any student who is involved with a campus-wide or district-wide issue can really expect to face consequences. We'll keep you posted on what we learn more. For now, though, that is the latest reporting live in Summerlin. Kendall Kim, back to you, too.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower.
It's great to learn,
cause knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', the chip off the block, on your favorite Schoolhouse.
story developing all night in Pittsburgh. Disturbing new allegations of racism in school.
Yeah, this is at Pittsburgh Mendon. It comes as the district has now been put on notice of a possible lawsuit accused of failing to take action.
A biracial student claims to be a victim of hate and says the district did nothing to correct it. Good evening. I'm Don Elhart.
And I'm Jenny Ryan. We have new information and reaction from the Pittsburgh District tonight. School leaders say they are renewing their commitment to addressing any form of racism.
Amanda Valdez live at Pittsburgh Mendon High, where another alleged act of hate surfaced today. Amanda?
Yeah, Don, and district leaders are clear in their message tonight, saying acts of hate will carry serious consequences. Now, the notice of claim says that the student here at the high school has been verbally attacked since February, and now the family has had enough.
The accusations listed in this notice of claim say there's been months of alleged hateful name-calling and actions aimed towards a biracial student at the Pittsburgh Mendon High School, leaving behind trauma and embarrassment. Now the family is preparing legal action against the Pittsburgh Central School District. The news is concerning to parents.
I think we need to look at both sides, because the hate of any form affects not only the person it's targeted against, it also affects the person who hates.
Beckford says it's shocking to hear the number of alleged acts of racism happening to students. District leaders say they are committed to dealing with all acts of bias, but the notice of claim says otherwise, stating the superintendent promised to take action to remedy the alleged acts of racism towards a biracial student at the start of the month, but has not done so to this day.
It's not clear to me why that sort of knowledge from a district perspective didn't translate into some action earlier.
In fact, another alleged racial incident happened today at Pittsburgh Mendon. An email from the principal to staff said a swastika and the N-word were written on the desk of another biracial student. Parent Jesse Keating is committed to working towards a solution.
We stand wholeheartedly with the children of color and the families of color who have been harmed.
In a letter to parents tonight, the superintendent wrote, "These incidents are deeply troubling and hurtful to all, but they are especially cruel to those who are the direct targets of such views. However, we cannot allow the hurtful actions of a few to define us, as they do not represent who we are as a district."
And we did call the attorney for the family tonight. He has no comment. Now, tomorrow night, students are invited to the Pittsburgh Community Library. Starting at 7 o'clock, there is a forum going on there to talk about racism. For now, we're live in Pittsburgh. Amanda Valdez, 13 WHAM News.
The Watcher. The Watcher. The Watcher. The Watcher.
San Francisco houses the nation's biggest tech hub, as you probably know, but this week it became the first city to ban facial recognition technology. As most major cities are accelerating the use of various surveillance technologies, this ban exposes a deeper debate here in New York and elsewhere about the flaws of surveillance technologies and the potential for abuse of power and, let's face it, creepy invasions of privacy. So what is this groundbreaking San Francisco law, and should New York do something similar? With us now is police reform and anti-surveillance advocate Albert Fox Kahn. He's executive director of the social justice organization called the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project of the Urban Justice Center, and he's here in our studio. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give us the local context a little bit first. Where and how does facial recognition surveillance exist in New York today?
Yeah, New York actually has one of the broadest deployments of facial recognition anywhere in the country. We see a few different deployments, both with the NYPD. They have a large facial recognition database where they'll take a suspect's image image, run it through that database, and try to identify who the perpetrator of a crime is. We also have an MTA project. This went into effect last year, and this is trying to scan drivers' faces in real time as they use some of the bridges and tunnels around the city. This is a program that's been highly problematic, both from a technical perspective and also a civil rights perspective.
So wait, I'm driving over the Throg's Neck and something's taking my picture?
Yeah. So when we went to cashless tolling, we started using a form of automated license plate readers. These are cameras that can detect what your license plate number is, feed that into a database. And so, you know, the MTA took it a step further and said, okay, let's start scanning faces too. The problem is that with all of these technologies, it's that there's bias. There's really a lot of evidence showing that facial recognition works much less effectively for women, for communities of color, and it creates a lot of false identifications. And so that, as an activist, as a reformer, creates a lot of concern about the possibility of a digital stop and frisk.
So have they actually used it in any enforcement way, or are they just collecting these photos of drivers at this point?
Well, for the bridge and tunnel version, that was a bust. So they were trying to capture photos of drivers at high speed, photographing us through the windshield, and no surprise, it didn't work. And So the Wall Street Journal reported that they hadn't even detected a single face. Huh. But then we see these other programs, like the New York Times reported that there was facial recognition monitors in the Times Square subway station. And so, you know, we and other activists wanted to know, well, who are you sharing the data with? How is this being used? What are the safeguards? We've submitted FOIL requests, Freedom of Information Law requests, and we're still trying to get those responses so we can know how that subway facial recognition program was used.
So that's how new this is. They haven't even given you the information yet, so you can know how they're using it.
Exactly. And that's one of the concerns we have, is that a lot of these programs are going into place before we have the structural safeguards to make sure that they're being used equitably. But for the programs that have existed for longer, like the NYPD's facial recognition database, there is actually two reports that were just released today from Georgetown Law's Center on Privacy and Technology that looked at a number of flaws that they've identified with how those programs work.
And what has San Francisco done? What is this groundbreaking law that they just passed this week?
Well, they took the obvious step of saying, until we have evidence that we know that facial recognition works, that it works well, that it works equitably, that it's not having a discriminatory impact on communities of color, we're not going to allow our police, our city agencies, to use facial recognition. And I think that sort of moratorium makes a lot of sense. And I think it's something that New York should follow.
When you look at a country like China, mm-hmm. with its all-encompassing surveillance state, are there things that China is doing that you're aware of that, or even any other country, but I think China kind of leads the world in this, that makes you think, oh, look what's possible, look what they're already doing, we don't want that here?
Oh, yeah. China is a cautionary tale for what a surveillance society can morph into. It's both the amount of surveillance. I heard a recent discussion where someone mentioned a 2-subway stop commute where they identified 250 cameras. 250 cameras. But then we also know that the camera system is being looped into a social credit system, which is being used to monitor a lot of people's behavior, eviscerating any right to privacy. On top of that, we know that the Uyghur Muslim community has been targeted systematically using this facial recognition software. And that's one of the dangers of these tools, is it makes it incredibly easy and cheap to automate bias and to try to create an algorithm to target a vulnerable community like the Uyghur community in China.
You've been talking a lot here about discrimination and using it unequally on people from vulnerable communities. Some people go even further. Two scholars, Woodrow Hartog and Evan Selinger, argued recently that facial recognition technology is the perfect tool of oppression. And they wrote, quote, "The mere existence of facial recognition systems harms civil liberties because people will act differently if they suspect they're being surveilled." So do you go that far, or do you just want to make sure that they're being applied in a non-racial or gender discriminatory manner?
I'm a huge fan of Evan's work, and I think that we may need to get that far. But what I know is that right now, we haven't been able to get to the point where we can even apply these technologies without discrimination. And until we get rid of that bias, we don't even have to reach the question if there's any place in a free society for facial recognition. That said, we have the Supreme Court, the John Roberts Supreme Court, not the most progressive court, strike down similar tracking systems last year. They said that it was unconstitutional to track people's location based off their cell phone without a warrant. And from my perspective, it's no different if you're tracking where I go around the city using my cell phone or using a series of cameras and facial recognition. Either way, you're making it impossible for me to live my life, to walk around the city without second guessing who's going to be analyzing my behavior and what costs may it have down the road.
So what kind of a law, a model law or whatever, would you recommend that New York passed? Would it be a blanket ban, like is the news from San Francisco this week, or some kind of mechanisms to make sure that it's being applied in a non-discriminatory manner if it has legitimate law enforcement purposes?
Well, I would love to get to a law as progressive as what we saw in San Francisco, but we're not there yet. So for a little more than 2 years, I've been working on something called the POST Act, the Public Oversight of Surveillance Technology Act. It's a city council bill which would end the NYPD loophole that lets them buy unlimited amounts of spy equipment with federal dollars, with private grants, without disclosing any of that to the city council. And it also would require them to come up with a privacy and use policy for every tool. So they need to have rules for how these tools are used, how the information is collected, and how that information is shared, which is really important as an immigration justice advocate to make sure that our surveillance state isn't violating the promise that we're going to be a sanctuary city.
Well, wave, everybody, because you may be getting surveilled right now wherever you are, and you don't even know it. My guest has been Albert Foxconn, the executive director of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project with the Urban Justice Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's the nation's capital, it's Washington, D.C. It's the nation's capital, it's the nation's capital, it's the nation's capital.
A new report from the ACLU presents an incredibly stunning, shocking, and downright mystifying new revelation in D.C. Black people are getting arrested at far higher rates than white people in the city. I, for one, am gobsmacked. How could this be? That in a city in which 47% of the people are black, they make up 87% of arrests? From 2013 to 2017, black folks were arrested at 10 times the rate of white people, the report says. Many black people aren't even good at committing crimes. In all seriousness, though, we know the truth. Racial disparities in police arrests are literally as old as law enforcement itself, as many police departments were based on systems from, you guessed it, the old slave patrols. It's almost like the very purpose of the officers was to arrest and incarcerate black folks just for living. Who knew? I mean, it's almost like living while black in the capital of the United States of America is a crime. Don't even get me started on driving while black. Shoo, let me get back up in the house before I get hemmed up for breathing. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
For a cop, as good as I, a Booker guy, but drinking crooked eye, don't resist, put him think I won't, but why wouldn't I? I'm a cop.
5 years after Eric Garner died in an altercation with New York City police, a disciplinary trial began today for the officer accused in his death. Officer Daniel Pantaleo was never charged criminally. This trial will determine whether he used a chokehold banned by the NYPD decades ago to cause Garner's death. If Pantaleo is found guilty, he could lose his job. Cindy Rodriguez from Member Station WNYC is covering the trial. She's here to discuss how day one went. And just a warning, we'll be discussing the actions that led to Garner's death in some detail. Cindy, how did the prosecution lay out its case today?
Well, Audie, prosecutors had to prove that Officer Pantaleo used a chokehold, and by doing so that he acted recklessly. And they also had to prove that he intended to restrict Garner's breathing. So during opening statements, prosecutor Jonathan Fogel said that Eric Garner didn't pose a threat to the public or to the officers. He pointed out that Garner was unarmed, that there was no urgency to the situation, that he was selling loose cigarettes, which is a misdemeanor. Backup was on the way, and Pantaleo could have waited. But instead, he used a chokehold in what he called an act of brutal, lethal force. And he accused Pantaleo of locking his fingers together to intentionally squeeze Garner's throat and restrict his breathing. Fogel called it a death sentence over loose cigarettes.
Officer Pantaleo's defense attorneys have been trying to make the argument that the officer used a seatbelt maneuver, it's called, rather than a chokehold.
Right.
And that's a maneuver, apparently, that's been approved by the NYPD. Can you explain what a seatbelt maneuver is and how it came up in court today?
Right. So his lawyer said that Pantaleo used a maneuver by which you grab a suspect from behind and you put one arm under his armpit and the other arm over his shoulder and across his chest. And then you clasp your hands together and throw the suspect off balance so he falls down. The defense attorney said that's what Pantaleo did. And the only reason his forearm went near Mr. Garner's neck was because of Mr. Garner's large size. Now, here's the head of the police union, Patrick Lynch. You're going to hear protesters trying to shout over him. But Lynch is trying to point out the timing of Garner's last words, "I can't breathe."
Mr. Garner never said he could not breathe while any arm was near his neck. What we saw is a legal, trained seatbelt maneuver.
And, of course, that chanting in the background, I believe they're saying "fire Pantaleo." So, obviously, emotions are still running high in the community. I mean, how did this play out in the courtroom?
Definitely. So today was a very emotional day for the Garner family. When the viral video of the altercation was played, Garner's mother walked out and his sister sobbed and had to be escorted out. And then outside the trial room, Gwen Carr, Garner's mother, spoke underneath a steady rainfall.
"These are just tears from heaven. Eric is crying from heaven because he see his mother and his family out here still trying to fight for justice for him."
So, Audie, the trial is scheduled to last through next week, and the Garner family says they'll be there every day.
That's WNYC's Cindy Rodriguez. Thanks.
Thank you.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 1210-2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, it's, I mean, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
A mosque fire in New Haven, Connecticut has been ruled an arson, or is at least being treated as arson. And this is according to the fire chief. He says, quote, "We've detected that there is intent in this fire. This was intentionally set." Now, the fire nearly destroyed the mosque. In fact, they had been building it and remodeling it for a while now. And here are some of the people who go to that mosque talking about what they have experienced. Take a look.
It's like another home, you know? It's like I grew up here. And like it took so long for them to build it. Now this happened. Now they're going to have to start over, you know?
It affects an entire community, not just families, but people of faith as well.
So according to reports, the incident comes less than 2 months after another fire was set at a mosque in Escondido, California, which, by the way, was later claimed by the Poway Synagogue shooting suspect who referenced the Christ Church Mosque shooting in an online manifesto. So these hate crimes are happening all the time, consistently. And simultaneously, the fear-mongering about the Muslim community coming from the Trump administration and the right wing continues on, even though there's been all of this violence and all of these hate crimes geared toward the Muslim community.
So this is the new KKK. They're back. And so no ands, ifs, or buts. What did the KKK do back in the day? They terrorized people. They did bombings. They lit fires. They would do cross burnings in front of your house to terrorize you. They're the original domestic terrorists. The worst we've ever had in this country. Let me be clear and say that again. The KKK is the worst domestic terrorist we have ever had in this country. Anyone who disagrees with that obviously doesn't care about facts, doesn't care about the people that they terrorized. you would say they don't count under what definition? The only reason you would say that the KKK doesn't count as domestic terrorists, because you think, well, they didn't terrorize my people, so I don't really care. But they terrorized millions of Americans, and they did it on purpose. And that was exactly their point, the terror. And what was the other thing that they did? They firebombed churches, black churches. So now the new KKK, aided and abetted and egged on by the right wing, go around bombing synagogues or shooting up synagogues and lighting mosques on fire all across the country in an effort to terrorize people and to murder them.
And let me give you another example, and this is not too far away from New Haven, Connecticut. Just last month in Hartford, Connecticut, that's again less than an hour away from New Haven, staff at a mosque received a violently racist phone call from someone threatening to burn down the building, and that's according to the Hartford Current newspaper. So again, there are either very specific threats of violence against this community. There are actual cases of arson. There are actual instances of people shooting up the synagogues, which we've talked about on the show. Had this been a church, had this been an act of violence or an act of arson against done by a Muslim against any other community in the United States, this would be a huge story. But these types of stories fly under the radar all the time. Because they just don't matter. I just don't think they matter to, you know, the public's consciousness here in the U.S.
And you all know, and it doesn't matter if you're a right winger or not. If there was a string of Muslims going and shooting up synagogues and lighting churches on fire and doing massacres one after another, you know what would happen? National emergency. People would go nuts. That's all they'd ever talk about. And they would take actions against Muslim Americans, people that are coming into this country, and other Muslim nations. But it doesn't have to be just Muslims. Imagine if it was black radicals. Not that any exist right now, but if they did exist, I guess the fantasies that Bill O'Reilly used to have and a lot of Fox News hosts still have about Black Lives Matter. Now they're incredibly peaceful. They've done no violence whatsoever. But in their minds, they call them terrorists. They call them terrorists for what? Chanting, for a chant they didn't like, right? Imagine if Black Lives Matter started burning up white churches across the country, shooting up synagogues. What do you think would happen? That's all the country would talk about, and they would blame every black person in America. They say, you see that? Okay, they can't get them under control. Why can't the moderate blacks do something about them? Why can't the moderate Muslims, which they have already said a million times, do something about the rest of them? It's their fault. It's all of their fault, because the moderates won't do anything. If you say it about white people, they'll lose their minds. You can't say that about white people. You can only say it about minorities, and then it's all totally cool. So now the reality is, as we've said 1,000 times, we'll say it again, you cannot blame whole groups of people for the actions of some. But in this case, there are some people, not all of them, some people that are actively egging this on.
Yes.
And one of them is the president.
Yes, yes. And that's the point that I wanted to make. I mean, his whole campaign platform included this message of, I'm going to keep you safe. But what he has done is he has emboldened the worst parts of society, the worst people in society, to literally go out there and carry out acts of violence. He has fueled the paranoia among people who are mentally ill. He has encouraged people to act out in ways that disgust me and should disgust everyone in the country. He has taken whatever divisions existed in the country prior to the election and he has deepened them. And that is definitely clear in the increase in hate violence that we're seeing, hate crimes that we're seeing, and you know, these random acts of arson. It's not random. I mean, obviously it's motivated, but these acts of arson and, you know, these shootings that are specifically targeted toward people who are not white, who are not Christian. Period.
I mean, Ilhan Omar, a United States congressperson, got a threat, a specific threat saying, I'm going to put a bullet in your effing skull. The next day, Trump came out with a terribly out of context attack video against Ilhan Omar, insinuating that she was happy about the 9/11 attacks, thereby fueling more death threats against Congresswoman Omar. He doesn't care. It's not the bug, it's the feature. He wants to terrorize Muslims and minorities in this country, and he sets his hounds across the country, the new KKK, to do it for him. And sometimes they even pick up tiki torches and say things like, the Jews will not replace us. And then he says, what do you mean? They're very fine people. It's not like he's hiding it.
The only reason why anybody's having a false debate about it is because cable news must call everything 50-50 and must have false debates. So last thing in this is actually a silver lining. The local area churches said to the Muslims in the neighborhood who were affected, you come pray with us. And the local synagogue said, you come pray with us. And so they opened up their churches and their synagogues for the Muslim Americans among them. That is the best of America. Donald Trump and his new KKK is the worst of America.
Of FBI spies and spying. In light of the empty dud of the fall of the Mueller report, we have heard repeated charges of outrage at alleged FBI spying of the Trump campaign and administration. To anyone who has studied a smidgen of black history, especially of the 20th century, such a charge is quite ridiculous. Why? Because the FBI has spied on black activists for decades, from Marcus Garvey, who headed the Back to Africa movement, to Martin Luther King Jr., whose sex tapes from hotel rooms were sent to his home, and then there was the Black Panther Party. And in the case of Fred Hampton, deputy chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, an FBI informant slash provocateur not only drew a floor plan of the apartment, he dosed Fred's drink with secobarbital to make sure that when the pigs raided his home, Fred, too high on drugs, couldn't move a muscle. I stood in that room before a blood-drenched mattress in 1969. Spying is a long FBI tradition, but spying isn't objectionable when the targets are black activists. It's only an issue when they're spying on rich white people. That's the real history of the FBI. Spies and spying. P.S. If you want to do a deep dive into FBI spying on Americans, by the way, read the book called The COINTELPRO Papers, COINTELPRO, and it's authored by historians Ward Churchill and James Vanderwall, originally published by South End Press. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The Man Knot, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood.
Here's a puzzle for you. Do the qualities that allow a man to block 300-pound bodies every day have anything to do with the qualities that allow the same person to solve three body problems late into the night? Stumped? John Urschel can solve that problem for you. John Urschel is a former offensive lineman for the Baltimore Ravens, who holds a bachelor's and a master's degree in mathematics from Penn State and is currently pursuing a doctorate at MIT. Now he's written a memoir about how his love of football and his love of math come together. It's called Mind and Matter, A Life in Math and Football, and he's with us now from WBUR in Boston. John Urschel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to ask you to tell the story of which came first, the love of math or the love of football, or do they always kind of coexist?
They coexist and they intertwine. I would say when I was very little, I loved puzzles. I loved solving problems. And that's math. And I was fascinated with this sort of thing. And in high school, I started playing football and I fell in love with it. And then when I got to college and I started taking college math courses, then I really fell in love with math again. And that's when I really discovered what mathematics is and that I would be a mathematician.
So math started early with the puzzles. In fact, you write about the fact that your mom kind of tricked you. She was constantly giving you workbooks to work on while she was also continuing her education as a lawyer so she could practice law. Did you know she was trying to teach you math?
Yes, yes. There was no trick involved. I very much enjoyed doing these things. I was very excited about them. I have to say these were some of my fondest memories from when I was very, very little. So she was giving me what I wanted.
So tell me about football then. You started in high school, which for some kids is late. I mean, some kids in some parts of the country, they're in pads at 6 years old, 6, 7, 8 years old. So why football?
Why football? My father played college football at the University of Alberta. I really idolized my father when I was younger, and I always wanted to be just like him. And, well, he played football, so I wanted to play football. I couldn't play football when I was quite young because they had a weight limit. And I was quite overweight when I was very little. And I'm really thankful that I didn't play tackle football when I was younger because I think starting sort of in high school when I started is the perfect time.
One of the things that I found fascinating about the book is how you – particularly when it became clear that you could play football at an elite level, then you had to make a decision. Are you going to try to go pro or not? And this is where I think many people would have questions. And the question they would have is, everybody knows that football has a high risk of brain injury. It has a high risk of injury, period. I mean, what is it? I think I've heard it said that the probability of injury in the NFL is 100%, right? And the possibility of brain injury is quite high. So here you are. You're gifted at math. How do you decide that you are going to go play professional football?
First of all, this wasn't really a plan of mine. I have to say, when I was a kid, I loved watching college football, you know, football in the Big Ten. Like, Jake Long was my hero, and I wanted to be a Big Ten offensive lineman. And here I am, you know, I'm a senior at Penn State. I am a Big Ten offensive lineman, and I'm living my dream. And and I thought, okay, pro football seems available to me. People are talking to me about it. They have me on projection draft lists. And I say, you know what? Math can wait a little bit, and I'm going to go play football at the highest level because I can come back to math later, but I can't come back to try professional football.
Did you consider the possibility of a serious brain injury?
No.
You did not?
No. No,
now, that seems strange, given that you're very aware of probability, right? So
yes.
So
yes.
What happened? You just chose not to think about it?
You know, it was something that I had thought about at some point, and I recognized that there are those risks, and I was aware of them, but I was already aware of them, and I had already made my decision.
So you did get a concussion. In 2015, you were at training camp and you were in a full pads practice and you, as they say, got your bell rung and suffered a concussion. And then it was serious. I mean, you couldn't read, you couldn't do math. You had to basically lie around for a while, and I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, saying I couldn't read, I mean, this is a little strong. I was capable of reading.
Okay.
I was not capable of, let's say, like reading high-level math, but you know, you put cat in the hat in front of me. I can read this. You know?
Okay, but that's not your job. Your job wasn't – your future was not reading cat in the hat. Your future was doing complex math problems. So you couldn't do that for a while. So the question then becomes, was it worth it? I mean, you recovered.
Mm-hmm.
But did that ever cause you to question?
The concussion?
Yeah.
Surprisingly not. When I had the concussion, as crazy as it seems, I was really frustrated more than anything. That's the right adjective in that – you know, I love football, I love math, and I couldn't do either of those things at that moment. And it really bothered me. But once I got better and I was back to sort of doing football and doing math, I thought, okay, you know, if this happens again, I really need to sort of think and reevaluate. But I like where I am right now, and I want to keep playing football and keep doing math, and I'm going to just keep doing both these things, and I'm going to forget about this.
So what?
And
made
I did.
You did. So what made you finally decide to hang up your pads? It wasn't the concussion. What was it?
The things that sort of went into my decision making was things about mathematics, looking at my career going forward, sort of thinking about at that time I was going to become a father, And so this is something I started thinking about, you know, spending time with my daughter, being able to, you know, walk my daughter down the aisle, being able to sort of, when I'm 60 and 70, be able to run around, have my, you know, my knees be okay, my shoulders okay, my back okay. I mean, you know, of course you think about your head as well, but, you know, it's a very holistic thing. The NFL can really do a number on your body. And, you know, a lot of people are focusing on sort of people's heads, but it's sort of all over. And I'm blessed to have played 3 years in the NFL and by NFL player standards, retire completely healthy. Not by normal people standards, but by NFL standards, I am as close to completely healthy as you can get.
One of the reasons I found this chapter and your decision-making interesting is that you also talked about the fact of being an African-American in math. And there is this question of whether are African-Americans too invested in sports in this country as an avenue for achievement and accomplishment. I wonder, did that factor into it at all? That, yes, it's true that very few people make it to the NFL, but even fewer make it into elite levels in math. And I just wondered if that was part of the thought for you as being a role model in a different area.
Yes, I recognize that because I'm a mathematician at MIT and I play professional football, I'm in the spotlight. And I have a responsibility to sort of use this platform to show people the beauty of mathematics, to show people playing in the NFL, this isn't your way out. You can do something in mathematics. You can do something in STEM, even if you don't necessarily look like what the majority of people in that field look like. And I have to say, okay, if you look at sort of the field of mathematics, if you look at elite American mathematicians, there's almost no African Americans. There's not many of us in PhD programs. There's not many of us as undergrads. And what you're sort of left with is this sad realization that there are brilliant young minds being born into this country that somehow are being lost, either because of the household they're born into or, you know, their socioeconomic situations or sort of the social culture in their community. And this isn't just a disservice to them. This is a disservice to us as a country.
You still watch football?
Yes. I watch college football. I don't watch NFL, but
How come? That's interesting. How come?
I stopped watching NFL football, actually, the moment I got into the NFL. It felt like work. College football, I love watching Penn State football. I mean, I'm a Penn Stater till I die. And then I also love watching Western Illinois football, which is the team that my best friend in the world coaches for. He's the offensive coordinator there. So I follow them extremely closely.
Okay. Well, that's John Urschel. His memoir is Mind and Matter, A Life in Math and Football, which he has written with his wife, Louisa Thomas. And he was kind enough to join us from WBUR in Boston. Something tells me you won't have any difficulty getting a position someplace. So we'll keep us posted on that. Professor, soon to be Professor Urschel. John Urschel, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, May 18, 2019. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, suggestions, counter-racist observations that you would like to share. The number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. All right, 2 days in a row. Discombobulated at the moment that we were supposed to go live. So We just heard the sound clip on John Erskine, a former NFL football player, played for the Baltimore Ravens, just has this book come out, talks about being a black male and a mathematician, no less. We need more black people in STEM, as they say, and racism, white supremacy, and all of that. The football issue that we have talked about before, black males being chewed up physically, brain damage, all of that, you're not supposed to be thinking anyway, or reading, no less, teaching, certainly not. So while this report is airing, I'm checking, because they said he wrote, Mr. Erskine, he wrote this book with his wife. So I say, oh, let's, you know, see who his wife is. She's not on the interview, and I don't keep up with Mr. Erskine like that. So his wife is Louisa Thomas. I check right as we're about to go online. I check just to confirm. Victim. And he said brain damage. Had that concussion. Brain damage. Not healthy. Victim of racism. White supremacy. Things to share before we get to be listeners. I want to get this in now just because of the importance. They had the sound clip. It was near at the beginning, talking about the adverse impact of processed foods. Everything that they mentioned, the cereals, the drinks, all of the microwave dinners, prepared food, all of that, and how that made people gain even more weight as opposed to eating whole grains, whole foods. They had that plant-based yoga retreat in Virginia. We did not have lots and lots of processed foods. Now, you can be vegan and still have a lot of processed foods. They got, you know, vegan corn chips and potato chips and Doritos and, you know, all kinds of wackiness, vegan donuts. All of that is processed. So it would be best fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, legumes, beans, that sort of thing. That would be much, much better than Cheetos chicken sandwich and the like. Super important. That is a major component of counter racism, black self-respect. That was said at the retreat. That is the protest right there. I'm not going to have all the bacon, all the potato chips, all of the cheese, all the processed foods and dessert items and sugary snacks and high fructose corn syrup and end up dying at 51. We talked about John Singleton this week. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. And even if I do, you know, manage to have more years, have really poor health because I've been eating all of these poison food. Dr. Kanban talks about that quite a bit. Aiming to have Cal's 10-year anniversary yoga retreat number two, Labor Day weekend, which is August 29, which is a Thursday, to Sunday, September 1, 4 days, 3 nights, plant-based meals for the duration. Not a whole lot of processed foods there. That was one suggestion from the first time around. More fresh fruits and vegetables. That should be easy being in Southern California in the summertime. Super easy to have lots and lots of fresh produce. 4 days, 3 nights, yoga in the morning, yoga in the evening, private lake. Looking forward to hanging out. Beds for all. No mud, counter-racist workshops, dialogue on workplace racism. If you're interested in hanging out, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. First portion deposit, non-refundable deposit, $400 due. First week in June, final installment, $375 due the first week in August. Again, the dates for the retreat, Thursday, August 29 through Sunday, September 1. Lodging, all meals, all plant-based included, yoga included. All you have to do is get there. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Whether you're at the retreat or no, certainly exercise. Eating correctly as best you can, hugely important. I did give out a suggestion. I was trying to give out suggestions before about how you can alter your diet if you're trying to make changes in what you eat, getting away from all the meats and cheese and all that stuff. I was talking to someone and they were saying that they had a really difficult time with cheese. They love cheese. I used to love cheese. The first when I went vegan some years ago, initially, that was something that was very difficult for me to give up. And cheese has a lot of addictive properties in addition to being not very helpful in terms of your diet. So I can understand now, I have a better understanding of why I've heard that from so many people and experienced it myself, having a difficult time letting go of cheese. What I suggested, you don't have to stop immediately. I think the metaphor they sometimes invoke, cold turkey. You don't have to do that. You can gradually reduce your intake. That's what I did when I became plant-based initially. I didn't stop eating cheese altogether. I just said I'm going to start to cut back and minimize. So it went from just eating cheese whenever to maybe if I buy cheese, I'm going to buy cheese one time, and I'm going to make sure that this cheese I don't buy anymore for 2 weeks. So when it's out, I'm out. That means I'll just have to use a lot less. I'll have to ration and just cut back and cut back and cut back. And gradually get to letting it. You can do that with a lot of different things. I was talking to someone and they had kind of a sugar addiction, which most people do. Same thing. If it's beverages, if it's sugary snacks, I think it was cereal for this person. And you just, you know, gradually reduce. You're not going to be eating, you know, lentils and having a full vegan diet with kale and lentils and black rice. That's probably not going to be the case immediately. And your taste buds, your tastes will change. That is something that was the case for me. I think it's been the case for a lot of people. If you're eating a lot of heavy, sugary foods, salted foods, high fructose corn syrup, all those chemicals, ultra processed foods, if you're eating a lot of that, that's so overwhelming, all that MSG. When you get to whole foods, just an apple, just an avocado, just a grapefruit, it takes a little while for your taste to adjust to not being bombarded with all those chemicals. We're just getting a regular apple. Oh, okay. Wow, it's been so long. I forgot what an apple is. I forgot what kale is supposed to taste like, or, you know, all the rest of it. It can take a while. When I say some time, for some people it can be months, for some people it can be weeks. I guarantee you, if you stick with that diet, not taking in all the rubbish food, and eating quality whole foods as best you can, 6 months, you'll notice a huge difference. Enormous. I can give you a personal anecdote before I move forward. I consume mangoes. I love mangoes, fresh mangoes, dried mangoes. Before, when I was tubby, not taking care of myself, no yoga, I would get dried mangoes, not paying attention. They would have sugar added and all that other stuff. Loved them anyway. Being more mindful, started getting dried mangoes, no sugar added, organic, enormous difference. They're still tasty, but it's a huge difference. After eating those for 6 months, I go back and get one of the dried mangoes with the sugar added that I used to eat. I could only get two of them. I was overwhelmed by how sweet they were, and unnecessarily sweet. Like, I was absolutely stunned. And that's what your tastes will change, especially when you leave all the chemicals alone. And just mangoes are sweet already. The creator made them that way. You do not need to dump a bunch of white sugar to improve anything. Adding white to pretty much anything, any situation, anything generally is not going to be an improvement. Next. My list of items. Oh, Mr. Erskine, victim of racism, feverish. Let's see. Albino Affairs, Sudan, the white rhino. On a system of white supremacy, I know Dr. Welsing, we talked about this. We had our Albino Affairs segment for years on the broadcast. Whites, that's even mentioned in Sundown Town. Sometimes they make their all white Sundown Town, they'll get an albino squirrel as the mascot for the town. The amount of attention and compassion and resources that they will invest in these frequently endangered, vulnerable white beings or species. They were talking about in that segment with Sudan, the white rhino, collecting testicular tissue from this beast in order to cryogenically freeze these samples so that they can do later DNA tests, cloning, who knows, in vitro fertilization, who knows? Wow. I've said regularly it gets to the genital level quickly. system of racism, white supremacy, even when they're dealing with albino critters, apparently. It still gets to the genital area quickly. And just the resources on a continent with all of these problems. They just had that cyclone on the continent and all of these different problems caused directly, indirectly by the system of white supremacy. Not that I have anything against, you know, Sudan, the white rhino. I don't. Sudan never called me a nigger. But wow, in a system of racism, white supremacy, white people can invest those type of resources and time and energy, travel from Canada to do a documentary film on this rhino and the non-white people that are being mistreated in Canada and beyond. Wow. Priorities. Let's see. The section with David Wilson, Rob Compton, they were one of the first gay couples, so-called, to be married in Boston. Man, woo, gotta be on the grind. Let's see. So that segment, they didn't say anything about that in the clip, which may have been an act of racism, white supremacy, but that was a black male and someone who looked like they would be classified as a white man in this union. I thought that was significant because that report was at NPR and they had a photograph. They don't have photographs with every story. Because it's audio, right? It's not like they have video. But they had a photograph for this story so that you could see the interracial union, joy, black male, white man. Mr. Fuller, the gay rights movement, so-called, is changing everything, particularly the manipulation of black people within all of this. But that was why I played it, because they didn't, I don't think, if you didn't see that photograph, I don't think, unless I guess some people maybe from The Voices, maybe you could catch clues, but I don't think that crucial component to that report would have been noted without me saying anything. Next, with Eric Garner, I think some of our listeners have pointed this out over the past 5 years. I try to as well when I'm able. I don't believe there's actually any evidence that Mr. Garner was selling cigarettes. I don't think that's in any of the videos. I think that's just something that people have become accustomed to saying. One, I think race soldiers might be doing that deliberately just to try to throw out any aspect, just to try to brand Mr. Garner as being some sort of criminal, even if it's just the petty offense of selling cigarettes. But I don't believe there's any evidence that he was even actually doing that. In my view, it's factually incorrect to even say that he was selling cigarettes or allegedly selling cigarettes or any of that. And the tackiness of that case, the segment that you heard, they did not include that the officer in question, this is not a criminal proceeding. Make sure that that is emphasized, non-criminal proceeding, that after Mr. Garner was dead, they said, we black male dead, it's not a big deal. Again, he gets multiple references. Again, this is why Dr. Curry's The Man Not, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood, one reason why it's in my top 10, how frequently it is referenced. Yet again, the worthlessness of black male life, black life in general, but especially black males. Ugh. Next, man, I have talked for years about not sanitizing when they have a report, some individual classified as white, child, woman, whomever, has been accused of some sort of racist act. And as opposed to just saying, oh, he called, you know, Leroy a coon and called little Helen, called her a spear chucker, as opposed to just saying that. So we, you know what the charges are, and then making, oh, we take this serious and this is not reflective. Before we can get to all that, they'll bleep all that out. So you don't get to hear, you know, what the person allegedly said. With the segment where they were talking about the high school incident, and they had this white race soldier made this video and they bleeped out every other word, you couldn't really hear what he was saying. Oh no, that one was important. You need to hear exactly what was said, because they didn't give enough detail. And in my view, that is another way that white supremacy racism is practiced. We just don't have accurate information about what it means to be white, what white supremacy racism is, and that mythology. President Obama even said the young white people that they don't know anything about racism. Really? Okay. This is read in Nevada. This is the Las Vegas Review-Journal giving more information about that incident. A Palo Verde High School student filmed singing song lyrics with racial slurs, and the phrase "they can burn in hell" is the second racist incident to go public in the Clark County School District in this week. The video shows a male student singing lyrics from a profanity-laced song that uses racial slurs in its chorus, throwing curses at Rosa Parks and saying Martin Luther King Jr. deserved to be killed. The section of the song that the student quoted uses expletives and racial slurs directed at African Americans, noting, "they could burn in hell" and "F Rosa Parks. I slapped that B as well." And the report goes on. I just wanted to make sure that was included because they sanitized, they redacted, just like with the Mueller report. And in my view, again, how is information withheld? Sometimes it's just redaction. They black things out. They did that in the COINTELPRO reports. What do you get access to? What do you not get access to? Every time, my feelings will not be hurt. I would much rather just, what did the person say? Oh, okay, this is what they're accused of saying. Okay, now we got it. Smack Rosa Parks. Dr. King should have been killed. Okay, gotcha. Next, great state of Nevada. Viva Las Vegas. The Young Turks report. I thought it was a major act of racism, white supremacy on their part. They talk about a mosque being attacked. They talked about synagogues being attacked. There certainly have been a number of incidents, terrorist incidents, where these synagogues, mosques have been attacked worldwide. Absolutely true. In my view, the correct assessment, and they would have the information because they did a report on the black churches being burned by a sheriff's son, no less, that was just a few weeks ago. They did a big report on that. And in 2015, days within, excuse me, 2015, race soldier admitted white supremacist Dylan Storm Roof within minutes of his terrorist attack in Charleston, South Carolina. There were other white race soldiers going out and attacking black churches. So it's not just an isolated incident. There are multiple incidents over years current. They, you know, went to the past with Klan attacks on Negro places of worship, but I mean current things, this year, things that they could have easily linked so that you get a totally accurate context for white supremacist attacks. They didn't do that. They excluded the attacks on black people and just we'll just focus on the synagogues and the mosques. I don't do that on this broadcast. I don't sit here and just we'll just focus on the attacks on Negro churches. I just played the segment. All of that is racism, white supremacy, and it played segments before. We talked about the Christchurch shooting. Racism, white supremacy is a global endeavor, and they attack all individuals classified as not white, although there is a special terrorist animosity for those classified as Negroes. They could have easily made that linked. They're informed. I can only conclude they did not as an act of white supremacy. Also thought the same racial narrowing term that caller in Florida coined, same thing, right wingers, that focus. If you are classified as white, your political affiliation is the party of white supremacy. All the rest is just confusion for the victims. And they do that on a pretty consistent basis. Mumia Abu Jamal, in talking about surveillance, he recommended Ward Churchill and Jim Vanderwall. I believe they both are racist suspects. He recommended their book, The COINTELPRO Papers. Have that book, have not read it in its entirety. However, I read their other book, Agents of Repression, the FBI's War on the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement. Phenomenal book. I would definitely recommend it. Lots of detail on the attacks that were carried out during the 1960s, 1970s, the attack on Fred Hampton that he was talking about. Lots of details, photographs of the room that he was talking about where the assassination took place. Just anyone, if you are interested in learning more about white supremacy, racism, or COINTELPRO specifically, Agents of Repression, pretty good book. Probably too long for us to do on the book club, but Gus thinks it is constructive. With that, I had I did have a yoga report, but I actually was going to use an audio prop to help illustrate what happened. And I don't have that audio segment prepared, so maybe I'll save my yoga incident for later, but always yoga racism incidents. With that, we are listener supported. Counter Racism Radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, the PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged for all of the listeners, investors who have supported us for a decade. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email and we can get you a physical mailing address. If you are not interested in any of that, you can also support via our wish list at Amazon.com. It is under Gus T. Renegade. Huge gratitude out to all of the folks, listeners, who have nabbed items over the last 10 years. I hope the cows has provided constructive, accurate information on what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what it means to be classified as white. For the compensatory call-in exclusively, I request that listeners not use metaphors. Let's make an effort to be direct, explicit about what we want to say. The NPR segment where they were speaking with Mr. Erskine talking about getting a concussion, brain damage, they said, you got your bell rung. If we're talking about brain damage, I would much rather, let's be explicit. Let's not try and use any euphemisms. If we're talking about brain damage, that's serious. Getting your bell rung, like, come on now. In my view, and that was Michelle Martin, victim of white supremacy. I'm a huge fan of her journalism work. But race soldiers, on the other hand, a metaphor right there, race soldiers, they will frequently use words, metaphors, analogies, similes, comparisons. They will use them to practice deception, racism. They'll often take two entities, contrast them and say, oh, they're identical, exactly the same. Frequently, that's not the case at all. This is just a master deceiver at work. Victims of white supremacy, myself included, we are still learning. We've been exposed to this misconduct for a lot of years. And sometimes we just don't have the logic, or we just don't have our thoughts formed to articulate what we want to say. And we will invoke a metaphor of some sort to convey our thoughts. And often that just adds to the confusion. If we could just be direct, explicit with what we'd like to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Counter-racist code is supposed to involve minimizing eating out. Felt compelled to say that for some reason. That was something that I used to stress quite a bit in terms of saying it on a more frequent basis, but I do feel like a lot of victims of white supremacy do still eat out quite a bit. I think it would be important, logical, common sense, really, in a system of white supremacy for us to minimize the opportunities for racists to put something in our mouth. I guess that'll be a question I ask as we move forward. *61, if you have commentary as you're sharing, have you minimized how much you eat out as you've learned about counter racism, or do folks still go out and eat, you know, same regularity? You just go to facilities where it's owned by non-white people, or has that impacted your conduct at all as you've learned about white supremacy racism? I'll ask, and folks can share on that as we proceed. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Greetings. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I was at the retreat This is the Black African, and yeah, I've been vegan and I've been doing yoga and also running ever since. I don't eat out as often as I did at all, because you just don't have, they just don't have the choices that you want. So you prepare more prior to even trips. I'll bring like fruit and whatnot. I think for me, the greatest thing that has happened for me in terms of the vegan eating is I think they call it inflammation. So I feel a lot smaller. Like I never feel, I guess, big or bloated or whatever, even though I am a big, I think I'm a big person. but I did drop a lot of weight. I think the retreat was like February, and I think I started like a week before with the vegan eating, and I was close to 250 pounds before then, and a little bit before then, and now I'm at like 215. So yeah, I also do some jogging as well, so that helps out a lot. The call in Florida, his term formations are really great. I would recommend that he writes a book at some point, and then not just the terms, but then where to use the terms, how to use the terms. I looked at Instagram and Mr. Urschel. Unfortunately, he has a white father. And I thought what was interesting was that he said that he loved Penn State a lot. He's a Penn Stater for life. I thought that was, I want to say unfortunate because of the Sandusky crimes and terrorism. And then the white rhinos, I've spent quite a lot of time in South Africa, and I follow things that occur there. White people were very much invested in the white rhinos. They would put like rhino horns on their like cars, but it would be like red, like in the color of blood. But what I found fascinating about that is that they practically own all the land. They have these, they call them game farms. So they own all the rhinos and all of these. But I thought it was basically set up as an act of racism to make it seem like Black people were poachers and that Black people were criminals. That's what I thought the whole white rhino thing was. Well, white rhino poaching sort of marketing and writing was. The Mozambique flooding, I remember as a child when I was in that area of the world, I saw a commercial. It was a commercial of, the reason that it was just so profound for me was that I saw, it was a commercial of white men. It was like a commercial for like a car, like Ford or something, or Toyota pickups. And they were going into Mozambique, like, and they were getting, it was like they were getting guns because there was a lot of fighting in Mozambique. I think like Samora Machel and the Frelimo and all of that. And I'd never seen a commercial like that. I'd never seen, in South Africa, I had never seen a commercial of white people going out and helping people. So-called helping Black people. That's the way that it was advertised. But then later on, as Black people in South Africa were demanding land back, I started realizing that white people were moving into Mozambique. And this is just my thinking, that the floods, if you look at Mozambique, those parts of the world, they're very, very agriculturally rich. You can grow a lot of stuff, just like in Zimbabwe or South Africa, is just filled with farms. So I'm very suspicious of the floodings. Then the last thing, I was stopped for so-called speeding. I was told that I was doing 67 in the 60. I think I confused the police officer had a facial expression of confusion, because I was calm. I just said okay to most of the things that he said. I asked questions. He asked me how to pronounce my name, and I refused. And then it was just because it was just it had nothing to do with the ticket. And so that's what I wanted to share today. Thank you for letting me share.
Wow. Refused to give a pronunciation of your name to the enforcement official. Wow. That is black self-respect. I am surprised that that didn't might have been thinking, who is this, you know, uppity nigger, not going to, you know, tell me how to pronounce his flipping name. Did you have any thoughts that there might be some repercussions? Like, you know, you might cause further problem by not, you know, telling him how to pronounce your name?
No, because I like quickly after that asked the question about like my ticket. There wasn't a price, like a fee on there. He told me to call some number. So he asked me to like, how do you say, like, sort of like, how do you say your name? And I was like, could you tell me how you say it? And I said, no. And then I went straight to the question. So he had no time to sort of like respond or act.
Mm. Keep it moving right to the questions. Keep it moving right to the questions. Outstanding. Well, I am sad that that happened to you. Glad you got through it safely, but outstanding effort, black self-respect, asking questions, and you are not obligated. All of their requests, really any white person, badge or no, you are not necessarily obligated to do everything that they say at all times. Very important to remember that. Much obliged, the black African. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary. Oh, and 35 pounds, my goodness, 35 pounds. Congratulations. I'm amazed that I had that written down when you had the race soldier incident. That is spectacular. I'm so happy to hear that. Please keep it up. That is, you know, a huge component that was said at the retreat, a huge component of black self-respect, of counter-racism, just having our weight be close to what it should be, not having us weighing way more than what we should because we been eating all these poisoned foods and not being able to take care of ourselves and stressed, being stopped and harassed and then going to eat bad foods to compensate for that. Just, I'm so pleased. I'm so proud. Keep up the outstanding work, eating well, and hopefully you can influence other people around you to be more mindful about what they're eating and snacks and all that stuff. Outstanding work. Keep it up, sir. Other folks who dialed in that we've missed so far, if you have commentary, proceed. Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. Man, the rhino this week, the koala bear, cute little koala bears are now officially listed as functionally extinct, all due to white supremacy. So I can't even think that we have accurate count on how many animals are now extinct since these people have been in control. But I would say that it's more than they'll ever let us know. They keep showing us bones and saying these animals lived thousands and millions of years ago. It's probably something that they already extincted, and they just don't want to tell us. Facial recognition technology. The first industry to use this technology was the gaming industry. And this was back in the 70s. So if you got caught cheating in Caesars in Las Vegas, your face would be recognized by cameras at Caesars in Atlantic City pretty accurately. And they would stop you from gambling there. Now it's been expanded. Now people are programming this technology, mostly white people, white men, and they inject their own biases into this technology. The same Amazon facial recognition technology that's almost 100% accurate when it comes to identifying white men was identifying black men and associating them to monkeys and apes. So therefore, that's what the people who programmed them the technology how to identify a black person. They were using monkeys and apes as a template. Now, they already say consistently black people all look alike. That's another reason why these white people, I believe, are programming this technology this way, because they don't, you know, they think we all look alike in a certain aspect. And even more than that, I also hear white people say black people all act alike. So San Francisco, a place where the technology that they're talking about is made, decides they don't want to use the technology there. However, they have other forms of biometrics, because that's what facial recognition technology is. It's a biometric that's more accurate than facial recognition technology inside their cameras. I have an article where they have behavioral recognition technology cameras in San Francisco. All black people act alike. So we're going to be have the same problem when they put those online. Now, they keep us focused on the social credit. Remember, this is not a socialist country. This is the United States of America. These people deal with capitalism. The system that they're implementing is called surveillance capitalism. So you go from feudal capitalism to mercantile capitalism to industrial capitalism to now surveillance capitalism. It's all based off this whole economy is going to be based off of what you pay attention to. Let's just say people, these companies are surveilling you. You've given them all your information. This is Uber, Lyft, and Tesla. All car companies. Uber and Lyft are getting killed on the stock market. But however, those three companies right now have a higher market cap than Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler. So what are they selling? Uber and Lyft don't even sell cars, but they sell information. They know where you go. They know what type of places you go to, what time you go to those places. That's all valuable. The four largest collectors of data and the four largest companies in the world, ironically, are Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, which is Google, and Microsoft. They own the cloud. That everyone is using, or the data is being stored on. You have to get it from them, one of those companies. So either way, veganism is big on Wall Street. Thus, they had this company called Beyond Meat, and it's doing very well. It's having one of the highest IPOs ever. So in the 1 month, they're worth half of McDonald's, and they're worth more than Tyson. And they got this other company called Impossible Meats. So they make an Impossible Burger that everyone's up in arms about. And I'm just like, that's all I can say about it. I got an article. I got two articles I want to do. AR Digital Signage Battles Racism with Contactless Payments. Digital signage, this is like if you go to the movies, go to a 3D movie and you put the 3D glasses on and you watch the movie, well, this will be a sign that you walk past, but you won't need the glasses. It'll look just like the 3D movie is popping out at you. It's from digitalsignagetoday.com. Racism is a serious issue worldwide, and the Norwegian Center Against Racism in Lillestrøm was looking for a way to combat its spread in Norway. Norway deployed outdoor displays, which feature a video of a group of white supremacists seemingly marching to a pedestrian. The group was chanting, "White and free, don't take over our country." In Norwegian, many wore ski masks to conceal their faces. One video featured a white supremacist approach with a bat and virtually bang it against the display. So this is like at their bus stop while they're sitting there waiting for the bus. This sign is popping out at them, and it has these white supremacists walking toward them, and it's designed to make them feel guilty. The side of the display is features an integrated contactless payment terminal, which asks the viewers to donate money to stop the video. When the donation is made with a credit card or debit card, the white supremacist stops speaking, and the display says thank you. So they're paying this sign to stop because they're shaming them into feeling bad about the racism happening in Norway. This will never work in the United States because I don't see nobody. They will love this. They'll be sitting around watching this with cheers and everything. This would not affect them at all here. But I just thought that was very interesting. And the last one, I'm just going to read the title. I know I'm going over, Gus. I apologize. Suit alleges racism and firing of white Ohio State employee by a black force. It's from the Columbus Dispatch. A black person is being sued by a white employee of theirs, saying that this black person was racist. That's why she fired her. And I thought that this was very a good read, if anyone wanted to read it. It's from the Columbus Dispatch. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
I think I played that on the workplace racism segment yesterday about this white woman saying, yeah, she did. She got fired and she was terrified. That was the verb that she used. She was terrified that this could happen to her without any paperwork. She didn't have a review and they didn't give her a warning or anything. And this black fellow, her supervisor, he would say racist things that he despised whites. And it's terrible. That's why she had to file a lawsuit. Yeah, I think we played the audio segment from her yesterday. I, too, thought it was fascinating. Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, all the other callers. Eating out at restaurants. Haven't done it in quite a while. I just applied to it years. I'm, you know, very cautious any and everywhere I go publicly. Always in my in my head, in my brain, I'm basically formulating a counter-racist response to various activities. A white person, let's say, touching me or some sort of comment or question a white person would have, even some situations with non-white people. Because as we know that white people have been negatively impacted by the global system of racism and white supremacy. DCS program today. It's ironic that you played a clip on Chairman Fred Hampton. I was going to show the Eyes on the Prize segment of Chairman Fred Hampton. I'm attempting to improve upon my strategy and my format when I do show film. I want to fit it into a faction to where it will not go outside of the young people's attention span. So I think the Eyes on the Prize series, right now anyway, fits that means, because every segment is only an hour long, and within that hour you have two 30-minute historical situations, either with a personality or some sort of counter-racist attempt based on action from the system of racist white supremacy. And I was going to choose the segment on Chairman Fred that's entitled Nation of Laws. But the Wi-Fi ceased at the high school, and so there was no way I can to show the film. Let me ask you a question. The non-white black male, former NFL player, is that also? I remember mentioning him on the program I think weeks ago, something like that. Is that the same one that I was talking about that actually had a commercial where he was checkmating children as he was walking through the commercial? I don't know what was being advertised, but he was checkmating several people who had their chessboards out, and I don't know what they were advertising. Is that the same person?
I haven't seen that commercial, so I'm not sure.
Okay, it has all of the clues that is the same person, because he was an offensive lineman by the description that I think you were given. I think somebody was saying that one of his parents, excuse me, is a white person. So therefore, of course, he would have a slighter level of melanin in him and have some resemblance of where that is indicated. But it's probably the same person.
It's the same
person. And I'm not surprised that... What did you say, sir?
It's the same person.
Okay. I thought it was. And I'm not surprised about who is involved with sexually at all, because from the avenue of non-white black males, even non-white black males, where both of their parents are non-white black, when they go to those Division I colleges, they are approached by very aggressive white females. And so that's not surprising at all. What else? DCS programs. That's all I can think about right now as far as during the week. And I'll be quiet. Thank you.
Much obliged. Chess is an important one. Dr. Welsing talked about that game regularly. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, folks who have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. While folks are waiting, I will again stress the importance. Make sure you're also making some time to get some exercise in as well. Really important for stress relief. I know racists do a lot to aggravate us. If you can do something to get up and get moving, at least my experience, and I think a few others, that can go a long way. To help in dealing with some of that stress. Racists will give a lot of recommendations for stress relief for things that are not helpful, that will probably cause more problems. Doesn't have to be yoga per se, but some sort of exercise, something where you can move a little bit, sweat a little bit. I think you will feel much, much better dealing with all the strife of white terrorism. Let's see. Folks still spectating, or even a few more moments to get your thoughts together.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Emmy. Grand to hear from you. Hope things are well in VA. So glad I'm not there anymore.
Yes, things are well. Greetings, everyone. Not that I had anything I wanted to speak on specifically in terms of clips. But there is a theme, I think, always in all of the compensatory calls. And whenever we discuss racism, white supremacy, and people who are classified as white, violence being a very overarching theme. And they're very violent people, and we live in a very violent time, and it's just violence and aggression all the time. Getting to the point, I was looking for a good book to read.
Because I had just texted her and said, what the?
Oh, yeah? Anyway.
Sorry about that.
It's all good. I was looking for a really good book. You know, when you get that feeling, you're just like, I want to read something really good, something different. And there's a lot of like things that kind of led me to this book, but I wanted to share it because I've gotten maybe like a fifth of the way through, and it's been extremely impactful. It's called The Gift of Fear. Forgive me for not having the author on me. Like, I'm so tired. I'm getting ready to go to bed, but something in me was like, just make sure you share the book because it might be helpful for somebody somewhere. And why I was thinking about this is because oftentimes when we consider intuition, we talk about intuition as though it's like some metaphysical thing, something outside of ourselves, something that's not concrete or even scientific or even physiologically based, like it has some base in a tangible reality that we could touch. But it does. And so, you know, when I think for us people who are classified as non-white, I think we have to rely a lot on some of our other senses in order to make it, in order to know what steps to take next, what steps maybe not to take, where we should put our energies, because we're all developing our own code. So how do we do it? Like, what leads us to do what we do, if not something that's inside of us that sometimes we might talk or define or call as intuition. But so the book kind of called to me for that reason. You know, I was like in that self-help area. And so the book is based on like violence, how to detect violence. And the author does write kind of geared towards a female audience. But he says that because it's most violent, you know, very violent acts are committed by men. He's talking about white men, and he's a racist suspect himself. It's really from like these big cases with like the Unabomber and stuff like that. But the way that he writes the text and what he's calling to, I think is really impactful, especially for us, that it's all about your intuition or your instinct. And so not to get too scientific with it, but not all of the things that we perceive, our brain actually perceives. That's what a reflex is. A reflex is something that's like, oh, that's bad. We're able to respond without actually having to think about it or realize what's happening. And that very same process is occurring when it comes to situations, people, like anything like that. Sometimes our brains, a lot of times actually, our brains are able to pick up on things. We're able to sense things. But because we deny it, because we haven't really been taught to understand intuition as actual, like a scientific thing or an actual form or function of our brain, we kind of dismiss it and deny it because we've been taught to think rationally and logically about everything. That if we can't come up with why we feel this way, we tend to deny it. But then we find ourselves in dangerous situations, which is really why I wanted to share it, because I think that is critical. That part of our code is, okay, we're in this interaction. We've been pulled over, or this white person is engaging us and having a code on how we're going to interact. And then another part of our code is like how to avoid those situations altogether. You know, I make sure everything is in writing. I make sure I behave this way so as to, you know, avoid certain things. But sometimes besides all of that, you're still going to find yourself dealing with like a person or something. But let me be more specific. Find yourself in a hostile situation or in a violent situation. But what if we could train ourselves to really pick up on those things beforehand and really develop that relationship with instinct, what we call intuition? Anyway, the name of the book is Gift of Fear. But I really just wanted to say that because I really don't think that we that's something that's strong in us that we don't really use. That I think will be one of the tools, but nope, that's a metaphor. That will just be a good thing for us to use going forward. Hopefully it was helpful to somebody, and thank you all for listening.
Much obliged, Emmy. Stay safe in the Commonwealth. The Gift of Fear and Other Survival Signals That Protect Us from Violence. Gavin DeBecker, published May 11, 1998. That's when the paperback was released. How about that? May 18th. We're 1 year 1 week from when the paperback became available. But Gavin De Becker, if folks want to check it out, maybe we can do it in the book club if people think it is worthwhile. It is a national bestseller, so apparently a substantial number of folks have also found this book to be of some value. Reading is more important than watching television. I know Mr. Fuller, he did talk about how sometimes the creator sends us signals that we're supposed to be paying attention to things that are happening, things that are around us. That can be one of the components to keeping us safe. And he has another component, since I have my word guide. Intelligent fear, that's it. Let's see. Intelligent fear, there it is. Use this term to apply to the fear that a non-white person has of a white supremacist racist while that non-white person is speaking and or acting to replace the system of white supremacy with the system of justice. Intelligent fear is a form of cautious and calculated courage. I thought that last sentence was especially important. A form of cautious and calculated courage. And I've heard him explain this term before, that when you are honest about the situation that you're in, or when you're getting those signals that, you know, there could be violence, danger about to happen, you can better prepare yourself to make decisions to keep yourself safe, and just acknowledging that there is a potential threat. How best do we neutralize that? Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed. Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Jeff, and greetings to all the callers on the line. I don't eat out anymore, especially after becoming vegan. I don't even eat if I go to some type of an event and there's food there, for the same reason that the Black African talked about. However, in different places around the country, there are Black-owned vegan restaurants, and so I'd like to go to one of those, and I know of some in, like, New York and some places. So if I go in any of those areas, I would like to visit. I wanted to say that about Mr. Singleton is that we don't know why he died. We don't know if it was his diet. We don't know if it was lack of exercise. We don't know any of that. And when we link diet or exercise or whatever it may be to dying at a particular age that someone else died at, especially if they were Black, if they are Black, that tends to lead to people blaming those Black people for their own deaths when we don't know how they died. And I want to make this very clear. I'm not saying at all that you guys are blaming him or any of that, because I don't think that you think that at all. I think that you think that white people are to blame. Just from what I have observed in terms of your consistency and your pattern and how you talk about racism. So that's not saying anything. It's not an indictment on you at all. I'm just pointing that out because of the way that I guess we've been conditioned to react to hearing things like that. I mean, we weren't there when he died. We don't know. He was with, you know, white so-called doctors, scientific terrorists. White people could have killed him just for making roses. Mm-hmm. And there's no evidence that people die at 51 from the diet that we have here. And how can I put this? This country, out of 201, is number 45 on the highest life expectancies in terms of how long people live. So even if he did eat a certain way, there's plenty of people eating the way most people eat the same way here, and they don't die at 51. So we don't know any of that. But I do think that there's great benefit in being vegan. I'm one myself. I'm almost done talking, and I wonder if people would be discouraged from eating the way that most people eat here if we were more accurate maybe with our terms. Like, There's no such, it's not bacon, it's pig, it's not a burger, it's cow, it's not cheese, it's spoiled milk. I'm not saying that to disparage anyone in any type of way. I just wonder if these terms by white people are made to, motivate us to eat in such a way that definitely diminishes our quality of life, as you pointed out, Gus, even if it doesn't kill us. And I wonder if, like with the black African, when he said he didn't say his name. I won't say I wonder, but the interesting thing about the story that he shared about he wouldn't give his name to the cop is that people are always blaming black people for their own deaths. They're always blaming them when race soldiers kill us, when white people kill us, when the white people with badges want to kill us, the cops. And they that's the first thing that they'll say, that, you know, you didn't comply. There's an example of noncompliance. So if we heard of someone who died at the hands of or who was murdered by a police officer, and we heard of a story like that, but they didn't give them their name, it would have been, oh, well, they should have just complied. We know that they are racist, and you're going to sit here and tell him no and all this and that. And the last thing that I wanted to say is, I wonder if the word polite and the word slight and slightly were ways of white people putting in the word light to practice racism, and maybe we should use different words instead of polite and instead of slight and instead of slightly. And that was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
That's interesting. I have to think about that. For polite, that I could, if I process that, I can see the logic and why that might be. Courteous, you could just say courteous for that one. If people think that might be a way that they're just sneaking in, getting in another synonym for white in polite, as though treating someone well is white behavior. But yeah, I had to think about that more. Thinking about words, definitely encourage that. Much obliged for that, Ivy, and absolutely being mindful of victim blaming. Absolutely. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up and we've missed you, lines should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is Justmania. I wanted to comment on the book that Annie was mentioning. I also mentioned the book maybe about a year ago or some months back, sometime in December. I mentioned it on your show, The Gift of Fear, by Gavin D. Becker. I had listened to it on, they have it uploaded on YouTube. Yeah, and it is important, as Amy stated, you know, he also mentioned, because he is ex-FBI agent, and he does mention, especially going through the situation that I've been going through with my terrorism, with the, you know, the stalking and different situations that I've been going through, and how, you know, it is very important for us to listen to our intuition, because, you know, one of the situations that I've been going through is that second guessing myself, and, you know, just trying to learn how to trust my instincts and not doubt myself. That's something that I have been trying to practice, you know, doing, instead of, doubting myself. When I see something that doesn't feel right, you know, trust it, you know, don't second guess it, because, you know, that second guessing could be, a matter of life and death. So I'm just, you know, I'm glad that I'm learning to do that. And in spite of what others may think, you know, I have to if I see something that may seem incorrect, you know, as I've been telling you guys on this, you know, on the show, like there was a part of me that would, felt a little, embarrassed maybe, you know, about even mentioning, you know, what was going on with me. But I'm glad that I have been, you know, I've had the courage to talk about it and, you know, share it. And, you know, and it's been validated that it is something that I should be taking seriously. So, yes, that book was, very, instrumental, in me, you know, having courage to like listen to my intuition and that, you know, he gives very good examples of, like, I think one of the examples he gives about this lady that, like when you're getting on an elevator and if your instinct is telling you not to get on the elevator, with the person, you know, you had an intuition that before you got on the elevator, you saw a man on the elevator and something told you that, you know, your gut feeling, was telling you not to get on the elevator with this in particular person. How we second guess ourselves saying, you know, well, I shouldn't listen to that. You know, maybe I'm just being paranoid or what have you. But, you know, he tells you, like, you know, by you, if you would just listen to yourself when you had that feeling, it could have, you could have avoided all of the, you know, the problem that you got yourself into later on. Not that you got yourself into it. It's just that you didn't, maybe, you know, you just didn't listen to that, all of, you know, your instincts to tell you not to, get on the elevator with that person or be near this person at a certain time or what have you. So, it is important. And I just wanted to ask this question, but the, one of the clips that you were, playing earlier, it was, I think it was, two gay males that were getting married were, because I've been kind of like falling asleep because I'm, and, you know, I worked today earlier today, and I told you about my schedule yesterday. Was the men who got married who had they had a? I thought that it was a little. They went out of their way to do for these gay marriage guys. They had a sniper or something on a roof, or was he important? Like, was it the president of the United States or something getting married, or? Why was there so much done for this gay couple? Who were they? Could you tell me who they were that was getting married? Guys,
David Wilson, Rob Compton. That's their the two gay males' names. One of them is a black male, and the other appears to be mm-hmm. a male who would be classified as white. I don't know if they had, mm-hmm. you know. They don't, unless I've been misinformed, they are not presidents of this area of the world or anywhere else, unless I've been misinformed. I don't know if they had, you know, extraordinary influence. Maybe being gay is influence enough. But I too noted snipers, like, wow, people have threatened to kill me and harm me as a result of my work. And I did not get sniper protection or security guard or anything else. I did think that was wow. I mean, that is special. Sniper protection.
Yeah, they just really, you know, I just thought that was quite extra. I thought maybe we were going back in time. And so, I mean, is this the, you know, when they did the busing program or, you know, I don't recall them doing, going through all of that for, you know, the kids that were being bused into, different, to white schools or anything. So I just felt I thought that was quite strange that they had snipers just for, two gay males that were getting married. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Certainly significant snipers. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, I don't even know if they have sniper protection for Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, unless maybe she does. I'm not sure. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up and we've missed you totally, if you have commentary, proceed.
Guess, can I say something?
Emmy would like to chime in. Let's hear it.
I was a little scattered when I wanted to say it earlier,
but just to be concise with it, when it comes to, and I'm so happy that the other woman spoke up about the book. I didn't know that it had already been mentioned, in which case I think it would be a fantastic book to have as part of the book club. But also that it's like considering the animal brain. And I'm only so passionate just because every time I do listen to the news or turn into hear anything anywhere, it's just violence everywhere. And it's just going to be one of the things that will set us apart is being able to pick up on those cues and heed that signal and just placing importance on the animal brain, that no matter how intelligent we think we are still animals. We exist here, you know, if you believe in evolution and whatnot. So many things occur without our cognitive ability, and our security and survival is one of the utmost things that we've been designed to ensure so that we can be fit and reproduce. So those signals exist in reality. I mean, I'm not taking away from Mr. Fuller. I'm so grateful that he has that in his book. I'll check it later when I'm a little bit more rested in the word guide and whatnot. But they're cues. There were nonverbal things that the person did. It was a look in the eye. It was a twitch or something. And those things, I think, especially with such skilled, masterful people as like white people are, able to be so deceptive and violent at the same time. I just think that if we build that skill and develop that trust, that we will be just more successful in replacing the system of racism and white supremacy with a system of justice. Thanks for letting me say that.
Agreed. Definitely listen to yourself. I think the system of white supremacy, it does so much to get us to ignore our own thoughts, feelings, concerns, intuition, everything. It conditions. I think even people, that's been a theme on workplace racism, where being in toxic work environments can just further erode that black self-respect, confidence, where you just further diminish your own voice and signals that are designed to keep you safe. Absolutely. Maybe we should read that book. Mentioned multiple times for a reason. Other folks, if you have comments, questions to share, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61. If you have thoughts, questions, while we're waiting for other folks to chime in, if you have a hand up, if you shared already, if you have additional thoughts you'd like to share, feel free. We only have about 30 minutes max left in the program, so don't wait till the last minute, folks who dialed in, if you have a thought or question to add.
Gus, can I speak about the Beyond Meat? I was also looking at that that IPO, and I would recommend, or maybe I should, well, the way that I have been eating in terms of veganism is that I'm not trying to replace or mimic the food that I used to eat. So I'm not trying to, because I do go to vegan restaurants, and sometimes even like the black owned ones, the really great black owned ones, especially the ones that I've been to in like DC, they'll have like where they mimic something like fried chicken or a burger or some kind of like a chicken sandwich or something like that. That's not the way that I do veganism. I just eat fruits and vegetables and other things, but I mean, for example, one of my favorite things to do is to like get like two types of greens. I'll get like mustard greens, and I'll get like something, another type of green. And when you eat veganism, for what I've noticed is that it's really simple. You don't really need to be some kind of like cook or master chef. You know, I mean, you can just cut up these greens, just saute them a little bit, or saute them and just put salt and or salt and pepper or whatever you want. Sometimes I'll get like a spice pack, like tandoori chicken spice pack, and I'll put them in the lentils. So I would recommend not mimicking the food that you used to eat. Because I think that's how this company is going to make money, that it's going to be advertising itself as a vegan option, but it is not going to be, I don't know how it's going to be healthy, because it's just mimicking the old food. And also quickly, the wife of the gentleman, John Urschel, she seems to be a professional writer. So I don't know if there's a situation of ghostwriting or not, but her name is on the book. And then my last quick comment, Ivy, like some of the African language that I know, for example, like the term light, I think white people do a lot of, like, for example, the sun, the actual sun, in my language, the sun and the day is the same word, because that's when you see, I guess that's when the sun is out. So the sun and the day is the same word. And then the moon and the month is the same word, because the moon cycle makes a month. So a lot of I think everything that the language is in itself racist, because it has no connection to nature or reality. So thank you for letting me share.
Words are important. Much obliged for sharing. And all of that, you know, the Beyond Meat and fake chicken and fake burgers and all the rest of it that they're going to have, fake bacon, all of that is processed. So, you know, if you're trying to make changes, you want more whole foods, not just fake all of the craziness, fake chicken nuggets and fake all the stuff that you were eating before. Whole food that can help, I guess, with the transition. If you're having a difficult time and you've just been eating bad food for a long period of time, which many of us have, including myself, that you have a bad relationship with food. So it's difficult to transition immediately to just eating vegetables, chopped up greens, that sort of thing. You can use some of those, the fake burgers, fake chicken, that sort of thing, to help with processing. But really want to try and get away from that. And as was stated, that's just going to make probably lots of whites, race soldiers, a lot of money, who own all of those companies and are not doing anything to replace white supremacy with justice. Other folks have comments, questions. Again, folks that are listening in, has getting a better understanding of counter-racism, has it minimized you eating out? They have, really anywhere on the West Coast, they have lots of vegan options, restaurant options everywhere. I don't even partake in those because it's the same thing. Like, yes, I absolutely could go and get falafel or whatever else, soup that would be vegan and, you know, would be safe to eat, or put that in quotes. I would still be thinking I'm going and I'm allowing a suspected racist to put something in my mouth. Like, you know, how much trust do I have that this is going to go correctly? So I still don't do a whole lot of that eating out. They do have black owned restaurants here, and I do try to go to some of the Ethiopian spots on a pretty regular basis. They always have vegan entrees that I love, so that's something that I do try to partake in. Other folks, comments, questions they would like to share.
Thank you, Black African, for your insight on the word usage. I actually have a question for you and Gus, but first I want to say, Gus, over the years, you've been asked a number of times whether or not you are afraid that you will be harmed as a result of having this program, and you've given the answer that you've given, but it's very different to just hear you say directly, and I've never heard you say that someone threatened to end your life as a result of having this program. And I'm just really sorry that is the case. That's horrible. That's really terrible. The question that I have for you and the Black African, and I also want to make this very clear, when race soldiers kill black people, and when they kill non-white people, when they murder us, it is completely their fault, 100% their fault. So I don't want that to be misunderstood when I ask this question. The black African, he did not, he told the officer no. He told the race soldier no when he asked him to pronounce his name. You, Gus, have said that when the race soldiers, when they ask you for a search, to decline and tell them that you don't, that you do not consent to one. Me, I am very afraid, given all of the murders that I've seen, especially of black men. And so I have this mentality where I want you all to comply with anything that they say. Not because that's the right thing to do, not even necessarily because it's the safest thing to do, but I guess that's just the amount of, I guess, fear that I have, that I'm that scared, that I just, I guess maybe I'm hoping that if you just do everything they say, they're not going to hurt you, but they are. They have just shot people for nothing before they even had a chance to comply or anything else. So I know that. So even given that, this is my question. Why are you two not that afraid to that degree, given what you know about racism, given what you've seen? And I just hope everyone enjoys the rest of their weekend as best they can. I'll mute my line. Thanks, you guys.
Much obliged, Ivy. Black African, I guess she said that was to both of us. You want to respond first, sir?
Yes, sir. I guess I'll describe my emotions when that was happening. Emotions is the correct word, my energy. What came into my mind with Mr. Fuller's voice was that sort of like, you know, this is a race soldier and you're about to die, but, or you could very likely die. To be honest, I think that lately I've been a lot more calmer than I've ever been, because I have been stopped and I have been like, I don't want to say trembling, but close to it, like just scared, like what's going to happen. But I think when I was stopped this latest time, I was just so calm. And I think my mind was so focused on the questions that I wanted to ask the race soldier that it didn't come to my mind. And people ask me sort of to like pronounce my name, and it never goes anywhere. It's not like, it never goes anywhere. So I guess that was another thing. I was just tired of pronouncing my name, and then it doesn't go anywhere. Or the conversation doesn't lead to anything constructive. So yeah, I'm not saying that I wasn't scared at all. I was scared, but I was a lot calmer than I've ever been. And I think the show has helped me a lot. I mean, over the years, but especially this year, and especially after the retreat, I would recommend people go to the retreat. I would greatly, because I gained a lot of confidence from the retreat. Something that something that happened at the retreat that I thought was amazing was with the muddy situation, was that it was so constructive. Everything about the retreat was very constructive. Even the mud, like the way that we, it made me realize that yes, this problem can be solved, because we were just so constructive. And it was probably the first time that I'd ever had a full week, like I guess 4 days or 3 days of just constructive behavior. So yeah, I'm a lot calmer than I've ever been in my life. Thank you.
Labor Day weekend. We'll see if we can hang out again. And Florida, end of the year, just going in order. Florida, December 27, January 1. End of the year, so we can start 2020 in a correct frame of mind, correct thinking. But glad to hear that eating well, getting a little exercise, getting quality rest can have a big impact on how we find. That's why race soldiers, they invest a lot of time in making sure that we are not able to eat quality foods, that we're poisoned and not able to take care of ourselves. It has a huge impact. My response to Ivy's question, or my answer, the system of white supremacy is frightening in general. And if you're being stopped by an armed race soldier where you could die in a matter of seconds, that is a frightening situation. When they ask, you know, how do you pronounce your name, boy? Let me look in your bag. Let me search your trunk, boy. That might be, you know, you comply. Complying might be the best thing to do in that particular situation to live. The way that I process it, in the times that I've been in that situation where I've said, oh, you know, officer, I do not consent to searches of my property, person, or vehicle without a warrant, is that I could comply and they could still practice racism, white supremacy, and put me in a bad situation. Like, the way that I think about it is, absolutely, this could result in more problems. You know, they could pull out their nigger knocker and beat me down, or, you know, things could go bad. They could cart me off to, you know, the cage and beat me there. Lots of things could go bad. Or I could consent and say, okay, sure, check my bag. And then they plant, you know, whatever they, oh my God, we found a bloody glove and all the rest of it. So it's a lot of ways things could go bad. For me, you just have to make an evaluation as to what you think the best way to handle things is. And I've just concluded that a lot of times they use racists. They will use that fear that, oh, these, you know, niggers, they'll just do anything that I say. And frequently they will do and say things that are incorrect. And so the best thing I found, comply. If, you know, if it's obvious a situation where it's threatening, again, those cues, those signals are coming, you don't feel safe, this seems like it's something that could get violent, certainly you do what you need to do to stay safe. That's what I do. But I think just recognizing that there are a lot of ways racists practice racism. Sometimes they practice racism by assuming that we will be too afraid, too intimidated to say no, to even know that we have a right to say no, that this is not something that we have to do. And they can just do, oh, well, the Negro, you know, I asked and they complied. I didn't do anything incorrect. Well, you know, we'll see. I'll say no. And then if you're going to be very terroristic, then I'll go ahead and consent to the search. However, even then you say, well, I'm consenting under protest because, you know, I don't feel safe right now. You're asking to search my vehicle or whatever it is. I don't feel safe, but I'm relenting under protest. And then you go ahead, because I've seen where that can end up being important as well. So just comes down to whatever you think is the best way to handle it. And yeah, at least for me, racists have a lot of different ways that they can practice racism. So sometimes the best course of action is to ask a question or two, or to say no. And with, I don't have an army, I think I've said that over the years as well. I never say I'm not consenting as though I've got an army or a backup that's going to be coming to handle things if, you know, they talk biggity when I say that. I don't have an army, so saying that, not shouting, not yelling, speaking as a victim. Other folks have comments that they would like to share.
Sir?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
I totally agree, Gus. Consent, you know, don't consent, protest the consent. And if they continue to search you, you know, you comply. However, I think the next step that should be a part of our code is when something like that is done to us, to start taking them to court for violating our civil rights. And then if that continued to happen, I could see a stop, because that will, you know, cause to some type of restitution, probably monetary in some instances. And they'll see that we're on hold, and they would, you know, have to come up with another method of doing it. But the as far as a police officer, if they had probable cause, they wouldn't need to ask you for your ID. They'll just come and go in your pocket and take it if they thought they did something wrong. They don't need to ask you anything. So the fact that they're asking you lets you know that, you know, something's not right. There's a back to the one of the stories earlier. There was a guy in the Bronx, a young guy, she was accused of stealing from the Apple store based off of facial recognition surveillance technology. They said that he stole some Apple pens from a store in Boston. And the same guy, they said, stole some Apple stuff from a store in New Jersey and in New York. So the police go to his house and arrest him based off of this facial recognition technology. And then when they look at the picture on the report and look at this guy, they look nothing alike. This guy is a young child. You know, the night that they said he stole from the store in Boston was his prom night. He was at his prom. You know, you got the pictures. You know, I was at my prom. You know, I'd never been to Boston before. You know, so either way, this technology looked at him and said he was someone totally different. So he's suing Apple for $1 billion. I don't think he's going to get anywhere near that. But he has a $1 billion lawsuit right now. His name is Usman Ba. When you look at the two pictures, I mean, it's like, how did they get this wrong, you know? But this is going to be their next step of surveilling us. It's going to be these cameras they're going to put everywhere. They're not going to need to go and ask us for IDs anymore. It's going to pop right up on their little augmented reality glasses or right on their phone instantly. It's going to be, pretty much super speed how they can identify us in the future. So the stop and frisk and all of those things, that's what all of that was for. That was the data that they were mining from everyone all those years. They called the CompStat, saying, hey, certain amount of crimes happen here. Let's put certain amount of officers here. If we make certain amount of arrests here, certain levels of crime will go down. And, of course, it's all based off of black people, you know, the whole system. So that's the future of it. So the stop and frisk, the cop asking you to TID and all that stuff will in the future be something of the past because they already know that before they even approach, have your whole profile.
Absolutely. All that fondling, collecting data, same thing with the white rhinoceros, gathering data, doing all that DNA grabbing, getting blood samples. They were talking about that. Dorothy Roberts talked about that, getting massive database of samples from all the black people, non-white people that they have assaulted over the years, all ready for their new technology, 21st century. We have about 10 minutes, a little less, left on the program. Any final comments, questions folks wanted to make sure they share before we get ready to wrap things up? And we'll be back. The book club will be on Thursday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I neglected to include, there was a segment, it was another school incident. And they, I guess it's one of those schools where they have like a Native American mascot for the high school. And so this was brought up as an act of racism and, oh, this is bad. We shouldn't do this. Let's change the mascot. And we just had this in sundown towns. It was Chinks. That was the school mascot for the example presented in sundown towns. And they put it to a vote in the school and they voted 85% to keep the name of the mascot as Chinks. And then the school board, they came in and agreed, yes, we're going to keep the school name as Chinks. This school, they voted to change the mascot from a Native American photograph. He's got the headdress and all that. And they voted, 75% of them voted to keep it the same. And the school officials they agree. They're going to keep the mascot. They said they appreciated the experience. They had an opportunity to talk, engage in civil discourse about why it should be changed and what racism, why some people might find this offensive. But after all the good words were exchanged, why broke it if it's not, why change it if it's not broken? And again, white children, not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. Any other thoughts folks have before we get ready to wrap things up? Questions, thoughts?
Can I be excuse me, can I be heard?
Retired firefighter, yes, sir.
Were you aware of the law enforcement shooting to death the black female in Houston?
Oh, let's see. I did. No, no, sir.
Oh, okay. I was just figuring that you may have known about it, but you didn't want to broadcast any the idea of another black person getting shot down by law enforcement. Just a method of dehumanizing black people, that you can just do that at all points in time and just for fun, so to speak. But yes, I first became aware of it from a group text post. Pretty graphic as far as I'm concerned. I would say this: you probably would never see a white female in that position. And the enforcement official, it was admitted by the press that the enforcement official had prior contact with this black female, meaning that he actually knew her. But it was reported that she got close enough to him to be able to grab his taser, and she tased him. And that was his reportedly his motivation to, on film, you can see it on film, shoot her to death multiple times as far as gunshot wounds is concerned. I am not being pessimistic to state that I don't think he will get prosecuted at all. I could be wrong. I just don't think so. Anyway, I just was thinking about that. Thank you.
Hey, Gus, can I respond to that, please?
Thomas in New York?
Yeah, I saw the video on that. The lady was, she was resisting arrest. She was pretty much saying she didn't do anything wrong. You know, why are you arresting me, type of resisting arrest, sort of like Eric Gardner. And the cop went on to aggressively try to wrestle her to the ground. And once he got her down, he pulled out his taser. He tased her a few times. She was screaming. She was pregnant. She grabbed the taser. Somehow he jumped up. He said he was tased. And he pulled out his service weapon and fired at her, shot her five times while she was laying on the ground. She was a pregnant black woman. And that was a pregnant black female, my mistake. Women don't get shot on the ground like that. So I saw that, and I was like watching a lynching, as you would say, Gus. You don't like watching those things, because it's modern day lynchings that we're just looking at, and it did have an effect on me. Seeing that, it angered me, because she was in a position where he didn't need to use a weapon. She had nowhere to go. You had her cornered. It was excessive force. But the thing that stood out is the cop, even though he was white, he had a last name that would be considered as Latino or Hispanic. And but he's I expect to be treated like a white person in this instance to get off. He grabbed his leg when she grabbed the taser, so that's what he's saying, that she tased him, and that was his response. But after you tase someone several times while they're laying down, I mean, eventually I'm going to get up and try to defend myself, because, you know, that hurts. You know, like sort of like Rodney King. I mean, how many times are you going to hit me with your billy club, your nigger knocker, before I get up and try to, you know, get out of here? You know, my flight mechanism kicks in. And if she was pregnant, that motherly instinct, you know, because she sees her, looks like near her stomach. I'll mute my line.
The victim's name is Pamela Turner. Folks want to read. I have said for a long time, I do not. This has been my code for years. I don't watch, consume those videos. As Thomas in New York stated, it does impact your mental health, black mental health. They've done reports that have said these sort of videos and shootings do not impact white people. They don't feel bad or anything about that. So, but it does. And I've even said that I think sometimes that they plaster this type of footage out deliberately. The same impact of lynching. Sometimes they would leave the body out for days as a means of intimidation and terrorism. I think sometimes they report and show these videos just as a means of terrorism. This is, you know, who we got to shoot this week. Necrophilia. We talked about that, but Delectable Negro feasting on the corpses of black people. Talked about that a lot. Vincent Woodard, the Delectable Negro. With that, we will call it a broadcast. Again, we'll be here Thursday, Sundown Towns, James Lowen. You can check the Facebook page, Black Talk Radio Network, for updates for future broadcasts. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Be safe if you are out and about. I know it's getting warm and folks might have vacation plans traveled or just being out enjoying yourselves. Grand. The system of white supremacy does not pause for sunnier weather. So remain codified while you're out and about, especially if you are in a vehicle. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's preserve our brain computers so that we can work to create new concepts to permanently solve the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. And let's stay off the cell phone if you are in a vehicle. I know that's something that they additionally are using to harass and terrorize black motorists, non-white motorists in general. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.